Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
He was just, you know, sharing his thoughts on education and saying that it's important to get those pieces of paper so that you can get to the next level. And I think he explained in the clip why. He was on the program March 2011. The second clip from Dr. Kevorkian was from August 2010. When I heard Dr. Les making those statements about the need for black people to get those pieces of paper so that they could move on in a system of white domination, it was like bullet time from the Matrix. It was like everything slowed down and I could hear each syllable as he was coming out. I was thinking, oh my gosh, that is Ralph Ellis. immediately as soon as he said the word paper, I was like, that's going to be a sound clip. And I have been waiting a month to play it. If you could just share your view, am I talking crazy or would Ellison support what I'm saying? That, wow, when you hear someone saying black people, what you need to do in a system of white domination is get pieces of paper to move to the next level. If you are familiar with Ellison's work, should you cringe, Professor Hill?
I don't think you should cringe, but I do think the reason I love that clip is because I think Ellison would have a good laugh. And this is why. Ellison would agree, and this is what his hero is invested in, gaining these pieces of paper, that forces of power in the society in which he wants to be successful in have attached a certain importance to, right? So the hero, from the very moment that the text begins, is trying to amass these pieces of paper that will legitimate him within this society. However, Ellison's point, and I think we get to this in the second clip, in having the protagonist burn those pieces of paper, is that you are mistaken when you put too much, and when you invest too much in these pieces of paper without understanding what they represent. And this is what Dr. Les was saying, that it's really incumbent upon African-Americans, Africans, various ethnic groups, to both get these pieces of paper, but to understand the system that's awarding them. Now, what undergirds the kind of rationale from Ellison's point of view is the country is founded upon certain pieces of paper. Now, this is what gets Ellison in trouble with the Black Arts Movement writers of the 1970s, who really rejected Ellison, didn't feel he was polemical enough, didn't feel he was ardent or strident enough in fighting for African-Americans at this moment. Remember, Ellison publishes this text in 1952, before the Civil Rights Movement, before the Black Arts Movement. And when those movements burst upon the scene, he is not an active player in the way you might imagine. One reason is because although he has profound problems with certain aspects of American society, he actually is, in some ways, a surprising patriot, meaning that he believes that the country is founded upon some important ideals that we do not realize, okay? So the invisible man in his text invests a certain belief in these pieces of paper without understanding their true significance. And at the very end, in the epilogue, he finally comes to terms with the fact that he's allowed the pieces of paper to define him instead of understanding the pieces of paper and using them to formulate a richer sense of his own identity, his own African-American identity.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, May 11th, 2018. So I have been told. This is our second study session on Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. We only got to about the midpoint of chapter 2 last week, so we're very early in the book. For any folks who are tuning in, we left off the point where the main character, who is unnamed throughout the text, main character is chauffeuring the prestigious Mr. Norton, a white man. He's chauffeuring him around the college campus, and they are about to meet True Blood. We stopped right before they go to meet True Blood. So that's where we'll pick up at this week. We just heard about how beautiful Mr. Norton's white daughter is in a kind of pedophilic sense. Quickly, the audio clip that you heard, that was the lovely, and I mean lovely, Professor Lena Hill. She is a black female. She was on the Cows back in 2011. We discussed Ralph Ellison's book. She's written about Ralph Ellison extensively. She authored Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, a reference guide, which was published in 2008. She also published Revising Black Slave Bodies, Phyllis Wheatley, Ralph Ellison, and Artistic Authority. Just a quick snippet from that one. Phyllis Wheatley and Ralph Ellison used their pens to challenge visual depictions of black servitude. Their projects take aim at dominant notions of black character established by 18th century paintings of black slaves in recognition of the historical attempt to imagine a U.S. royal class. Black writers actively engage and radically revise traditional images of white power that rely on the black slave body. Again, the super lovely Professor Lena Hill. You can go back and hear that entire archive from 2011, our discussion on Invisible Man. She talks a lot, where I mentioned before, Ralph Ellison and his use of colors, the artistry of Invisible Man. Really pay attention to his vivid descriptions and the way that he uses colors throughout the text. Without further ado, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, Context of White Supremacy.
Half-consciously, I followed the white line as I drove, thinking about what he had said. Then, as we took a hill, we were swept by a wave of scorching air, and it was as though we were approaching a desert. It almost took my breath away, and I leaned over and switched on the fan, hearing its sudden whir. "Thank you," he said as a slight breeze filled the car. We were passing a collection of shacks and log cabins now, bleached white and warped by the weather. Sun-tortured shingles lay on the roofs like decks of water-soaked cards spread out to dry. The houses consisted of two square rooms joined together by a common floor and roof with a porch in between. As we passed, we could look through to the fields beyond. I stopped the car at his excited command in front of a house set off from the rest. "Is that a log cabin?" It was an old cabin with its chinks filled with chalk-white clay, with bright new shingles patching its roof. Suddenly I was sorry that I had blundered down this road. I recognized the place as soon as I saw the group of children in stiff new overalls who played near a rickety fence. "Yes, sir, it is a log cabin," I said. It was the cabin of Jim Trueblood, a sharecropper who had brought disgrace upon the black community. Several months before, he had caused quite a bit of outrage up at the school, and now his name was never mentioned above a whisper. Even before that, he had seldom come near the campus, but had been well-liked as a hard worker who took good care of his family's needs, and as one who told the old stories with a sense of humor and a magic that made them come alive. He was also a good tenor singer, and sometimes when special white guests visited the school, he was brought up along with the members of a country quartet to sing what the officials called their primitive spirituals. when we assembled in the chapel on Sunday evenings. We were embarrassed by the earthy harmonies they sang, but since the visitors were awed, we dared not laugh at the crude, high, plaintively animal sounds Jim Trueblood made as he led the quartet. That had all passed now with his disgrace, and what on the part of the school officials had been an attitude of contempt blunted by tolerance had now become a contempt sharpened by hate. I didn't understand in those pre-invisible days that their hate, and mine too, was charged with fear. How all of us at the college hated the black belt people, the peasants, during those days. We were trying to lift them up, and they, like Trueblood, did everything it seemed to pull us down. "It appears quite old," Mr. Norton said, looking across the bare, hard stretch of yard where two women dressed in new blue and white checked ginghams were washing clothes in an iron pot. The pot was soot black, and the feeble flames that licked its sides showed pale pink and bordered with black like flames in mourning. Both women moved with the weary, full-fronted motions of far-gone pregnancy. "It is, sir," I said. "That one and the other two like it were built during slavery times." "You don't say. I would have never believed that they were so enduring." "Since slavery times?" "That's true, sir. And the white family that owned the land when it was a big plantation still lives in town." "Yes," he said. "I know that many of the old families still survive, and individuals, too. The human stock goes on, even though it degenerates. But these cabins?" He seemed surprised and confounded. "Do you suppose those women know anything about the age and history of the place? The older one looks as though she might." I doubt it, sir. They don't seem very bright." "Bright," he said, removing his cigar. "You mean that they wouldn't talk with me?" he said suspiciously. "Yes, sir, that's it." "Why not?" I didn't want to explain. It made me feel ashamed, but he sensed that I knew something and pressed me. "It's not very nice, sir, but I don't think those women would talk to us." "We can explain that we were from the school. Surely they'll talk then. You may tell them who I am." "Yes, sir," I said, "but they hate us up at the school. They never come there."
"What?"
"No, sir." "And those children along the fence down there?" "They don't either, sir."
"But why?"
I don't really know, sir. Quite a few folks out this way don't, though. I guess they're too ignorant. They're not interested."
"But I can't believe it."
The children had stopped playing and now looked silently at the car, their arms behind their backs and their new oversized overalls pulled tight over their little pot bellies as though they too were pregnant. "What about their menfolk?" I hesitated. Why did he find this so strange?
"He hates us, sir," I said.
"You say he? Aren't both the women married?" I caught my breath. I'd made a mistake.
"The old one is, sir," I said reluctantly.
"What happened to the young woman's husband?"
She doesn't have any. That is, I...
"What is it, young man? Do you know these people?"
"Only a little, sir. There was some talk about them up on the campus a while back."
"What talk?"
"Well, the young woman is the old woman's daughter."
"And?"
"Well, sir, they say... You see, I mean, they say the daughter doesn't have a husband."
"Oh, I see. But that shouldn't be so strange. I understand that your people..." "Never mind. Is that all?"
"Well, sir..."
"Yes? What else?"
"They say that her father did it."
"What?"
"Yes, sir, that he gave her the baby."
I heard the sharp intake of breath like a toy balloon suddenly deflated. His face reddened. I was confused, feeling shame for the two women and fear that I had talked too much and offended his sensibilities. "And did anyone from the school investigate this matter?" he asked at last.
"Yes, sir," I said.
"What was discovered?"
"That it was true, they say."
"But how does he explain his doing such a monstrous thing?" He sat back in the seat, his hands grasping his knees, his knuckles bloodless. I looked away, down the heat dazzling concrete of the highway. I wished we were back on the other side of the white line, heading back to the quiet green stretch of the campus. It is said that the man took both his wife and his daughter? Yes, sir. And that he is the father of both their children? Yes, sir. No. 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 He sounded as though he were in great pain. I looked at him anxiously. What had happened? What had I said? Not that. No, he said with something like horror. I saw the sun blaze upon the new blue overalls as the man appeared around the cabin. His shoes were tan and new, and he moved easily over the hot earth. He was a small man, and he covered the yard with a familiarity that would have allowed him to walk in the blackest darkness with the same certainty. He came and said something to the woman as he fanned himself with a blue bandana handkerchief. But they appeared to regard him sullenly, barely speaking, and hardly looking in his direction. Would that be the man? Mr. Norton asked. Yes, sir. I think so. Get out, he cried. I must talk with him. I was unable to move. I felt surprise and a dread and resentment of what he might say to True Blood and his women, the questions he might ask. Why couldn't he leave them alone? Hurry! I climbed from the car and opened the rear door. He clambered out and almost ran across the road to the yard, as though compelled by some pressing urgency which I could not understand. Then suddenly I saw the two women turn and run frantically behind the house, their movements heavy and flat-footed. I hurried behind him, seeing him stop when he reached the man and the children. They became silent, their faces clouding over, their features becoming soft and negative, their eyes bland and deceptive. They were crouching behind their eyes, waiting for him to speak, just as I recognized that I was trembling behind my own. Up close, I saw what I had not seen from the car. The man had a scar on his right cheek, as though he had been hit in the face with a sledge. The wound was raw and moist, and from time to time he lifted his handkerchief to fan away the gnats. I, Mr. Norton stammered. I must talk with you.
All right, sir,
Jim Trueblood said without surprise and waited. Is it true? I mean, did you?
Sir?
Trueblood asked as I looked away. You have survived? He blurted. But is it true?
Sir?
The farmer said, his brow wrinkling with bewilderment. I'm sorry, sir, I said, but I don't think he understands you. He ignored me, staring into Trueblood's face as though reading a message there which I could not perceive. You did and are unharmed? He shouted, his blue eyes blazing into the black face with something like envy and indignation. Trueblood looked helplessly at me. I looked away. I understood no more than he. You have looked upon chaos and are not destroyed?
No, sir. I feels all right.
You do. You feel no inner turmoil, no need to cast out the offending eye.
Sir?
Answer me.
I'm all right, sir,
Trueblood said uneasily.
My eye is all right, too. And when I feels poorly in my gut, I takes a little soda and it goes away.
No, no, no. Let us go where there is shade, he said, looking about excitedly and going swiftly to where the porch cast a swath of shade. We followed him. The farmer placed his hand on my shoulder, but I shook it off, knowing that I could explain nothing. We sat on the porch in a semicircle in camp chairs, me between the sharecropper and the millionaire. The earth around the porch was hard and white, from where washwater had long been thrown. How are you faring now? Mr. Norton asked. Perhaps I could help.
We ain't doing so bad, sir. Before they heard about what happened to us out here, I couldn't get no help from nobody. Now a lot of folks is curious and goes out of their way to help. Even the biggity school folks up on the hill, only there was a catch to it. They offered to send us clean out of the county, pay our way and everything, and give me $100 to get settled with. But we likes it here, so I told him no. Then they sent a fella out here, big fellow too, and he said if I didn't leave, they was going to turn the white folks loose on me. Made me mad, and it made me scared. Them folks up there to the school is in strong with white folks, and that scared me. But I thought when they first come out here that they was different from when I went up there a long time ago looking for some book learning and some points on how to handle my crops. That was when I had my own place. I thought they was trying to help me on account I got two women due to birth about the same time. But I got mad when I found they was trying to get rid of us because they said we was a disgrace. Yes, sir, I got real mad. So I went down to see Mr. Buchanan, the boss man. I told him about it, and he gave me a note to the sheriff and told me to take it to him. I did that just like he told me. I went to the jailhouse and give Sheriff Barber the note, and he asked me to tell him what happened. And I told him, and he called in some more men, and they made me tell it again. They wanted to hear about the gal lots of times, and they give me something to eat and drink and some tobacco. Surprised me, because I was scared and expecting something different. Well, I guess there ain't a colored man in the county who ever got to take so much of the white folks' time as I did. So finally, they tell me not to worry, that they was going to send word up to the school that I was to stay right where I am. Them big niggas didn't bother me neither. It just goes to show you that no matter how biggity a nigga gets, the white folks can always cut him down. The white folks took up for me, and white folks took to coming out here to see us and talk with us. Some of them was big white folks, too, from the big school way across the state, asked me lots about what I thought about things and about my folks and the kids and wrote it all down in a book. Ha! But best of all, sir, I got more work now than I ever did have before. He talked willingly now with a kind of satisfaction and no trace of hesitancy or shame. The old man listened with a puzzled expression as he held an unlit cigar in his delicate fingers. Things is pretty good now, the farmer said. Every time I think of how cold it was and what a hard time we was having, I gets the shakes. I saw him bite into a plug of chewing tobacco. Something tinkled against the porch and I picked it up, gazing at it from time to time. It was a hard red apple stamped out of tin. You see, sir, it was cold and us didn't have much fire. Nothing but wood, no coal. I tried to get help, but wouldn't nobody help us, and I couldn't find no work or nothing. It was so cold, all of us had to sleep together, me, the old lady, and the gal. That's how it started, sir. He cleared his throat, his eyes gleaming and his voice taking on a deep, incantatory quality, as though he had told the story many, many times. Flies and fine white gnats swarmed about his wound. That's the way it was, he said. Me on one side and the old lady on the other and the gal in the middle. It was dark, plum black. Black as the middle of a bucket of tar. The kids were sleeping all together in their bed over in the corner. I must have been the last one to go to sleep because I was thinking about how to get some grub for the next day and about the gal and the young boy what was starting to hang around her. I didn't like him, and he kept coming through my thoughts, and I made up my mind to warn him away from the gal. It was black dark. And I heard one of the kids whimper in his sleep, and the last few sticks of kindling crackling and settling in the stove, and the smell of the fat meat seemed to get cold and still in the air, just like meat grease when it gets set in a cold plate of molasses. And I was thinking about the gal and this boy, and feeling her arms beside me, and hearing the old lady snoring with a kind of moaning and a groaning on the other side. I was worrying about my family, how they was going to eat and all, and I thought about when the guy was little like the youngin' sleeping over in the corner and how I was her favorite over the old lady. There we was, breathing together in the dark. Only I could see him in my mind, knowing him like I do. In my mind, I looked at all of them one by one. The gal looks just like the old lady did when she was young and I first met her, only better looking. You know, we getting to be a better looking race of people. Anyway, I could hear him breathing, and though I hadn't been, it made me sleepy. Then I heard the gal say, Daddy, soft and low in her sleep, and I looked, trying to see if she was still awake. But all I can do is smell her and feel her breath on my hand when I go to touch her. She said it so soft I couldn't be sure I had heard anything, so I just laid there listening. Seems like I heard a whippoorwill calling, and I thought to myself, gone away from here, we'll whip old Will when we find him. Then I heard the clock up there at the school striking 4 times. Lonesome like. Then I got to thinking about way back when I left the farm and went to live in Mobile and about a gal I had me then. Oh, I was young then. Like this young fella here. Us lived in a 2-story house alongside the river, and at night in the summertime we used to lay in bed and talk, and after she'd gone off to sleep I'd be awake looking out at the lights coming up from the water and listening to the sounds of the boats moving along. They used to have musicians on them boats, and sometimes I used to wake her up to hear the music when they come up the river. I'd be laying there, and it would be quiet, and I could hear it coming from way, way off, like when you quail hunting and it's getting dark and you can hear the boss bird whistling, trying to get the cover together again. He's coming toward you slow and whistling soft because he knows you somewhere around with your gun. Still, he got to round him up, so he keeps on coming. Them boss quails is like a good man. What he got to do, he do. Well, that's the way the boats used to sound, coming close to you from far away. First one would be coming to you when you almost sleep, and it sounded like somebody hitting at you with a big shiny pick. You see the pick point coming straight at you, coming slow, too, and you can't dodge. Only when it goes to hit you, it ain't no pick at all, but somebody far away breaking little bottles of all kinds of colored glass. It's still coming at you, though, still coming. Then you hear it close up, like when you up in the 2nd-story window and look down on a wagon full of watermelons and you see one of them young, juicy melons split wide open, laying all spread out and cool and sweet on top of all the striped green ones like it's waiting just for you so you can see how red and ripe and juicy it is and all the shiny black seeds it's got and all. You could hear the side wheels splashing like they don't want to wake nobody up. And us, me and the gal, we'd lay there feeling like we was rich folks. And them boys on the boats would be playing sweet as good peach brandy wine. Then the boats would be passing, and the lights would be gone from the window, and the music would be going too. Kind of like when you watch a gal in a red dress and a wide straw hat going past you down a lane with the trees on both sides, and she's plump and juicy and kind of switching her tail because she knows you watching, and you know she know, and you just stands there and watches till you can't see nothing but the top of her red hat, and then that goes. And you know she done dropped behind a hill. I seen me a guy like that once. All I could hear then would be that Mobile gal, name of Margaret. She'd be breathing beside me, and maybe about that time she'd say, "Daddy, you still awake?" And then I'd grunt, and drop on off. "Jemmins," Jim Trueblood said, "I likes to recall them Mobile days." Well, it was like that when I heard Maddie Lou say, "Daddy." And I knowed she must have been dreaming about somebody from the way she said it. And I gets mad, wondering if it's that boy. I listen to her mumbling for a while, trying to hear if she calls his name, but she don't. And I remember that they say if you put the hand of a person who's talking in his sleep in warm water, he'll say it all. But the water's too cold, and I wouldn't have done it anyway. But I'm realizing that she's a woman now. When I feels her turn and squirm against me and throw her arm across my neck, up where the cover didn't reach and I was cold. She said something I couldn't understand, like a woman says when she wants to tease and please a man. I knowed then she was grown, and I wondered how many times it had done happen. And was it that doggone boy? I moved her arm and it was soft. But it didn't wake her, so I called her. But that didn't wake her neither. Then I turned my back and tried to move away, though there wasn't much room, and I could still feel her touching me, moving close to me. Then I must have dropped into the dream. I have to tell you about that dream. I looked at Mr. Norton and stood up, thinking that now was a good time to leave.
but he was listening to True Blood so intensely he didn't see me. And I sat down again, cursing the farmer silently. To hell with his dream. I don't quite remember it all, but I remember that I was looking for some fat meat. I went to the white folks downtown, and they said to go see Mr. Broadnax and that he'd give it to me. Well, he lives up on a hill, and I was climbing up there to see him. Seems like that was the highest hill in the world. The more I climb, the farther away Mr. Broadnax's house seems to get. But finally, I do reach there, and I'm so tired and restless to get to the man, I goes through the front door. Now, I knows it's wrong, but I can't help it. I goes in, and I'm standing in a big room full of lighted candles and shiny furniture and pictures on the wall and soft stuff on the floor, but I don't see a living soul. So I calls his name, but still don't nobody come and don't nobody answer. So I sees the door and goes through that door, and I'm in a big white bedroom, like I seen one time when I was a little old boy and went to the big house with my ma. Everything in the room was white, and I'm standing there knowing I got no business in there, but there anyhow. It's a woman's room, too. I tries to get out, but I can't find the door. And all around me, I can smell woman. I can smell it getting stronger all the time. Then I looks over in the corner and sees one of them tall grandfather clocks, and I hears it striking. And the glass door is opening, and a white lady is stepping out of it. She got on a nightgown of soft, white, silky stuff and nothing else. And she looks straight at me. I don't know what to do. I wants to run, but the only door I see is the one in the clock she's standing in. And anyway, I can't move, and this here clock is keeping up a heap of racket. It's getting faster and faster all the time. I tries to say something, but I can't. Then she starts to screaming, and I thinks I done gone deep, because though I can see her mouth working, I don't hear nothing. Yet I can still hear the clock, and I tries to tell her I'm just looking for Mr. Broadnax, but she don't hear me. Instead, she runs up, grabs me around the neck, and holds tight, trying to keep me out of the clock. I don't know what to do then. Sure enough, I tries to talk to her. I tries to get away, but she's holding me, and I'm scared to touch her because she's white. Then I get so scared that I throws her on the bed and tries to break her hold. That woman just seemed to sink out of sight. That there bed was so soft. It's sinking down so far, I think it's going to smother both of us. Then swoosh, all of a sudden a flock of little white geese flies out of the bed like they say you see when you go to dig for buried money. Lord! They had no more and disappeared than I heard a door open and Mr. Broadnax's voice said, "They just niggers. Leave them do it." How can he tell this to white men, I thought, when he knows they'll say that all Negroes do such things? I looked at the floor, a red mist of anguish before my eyes. And I can't stop. Although I got a feeling something is wrong, I get loose from the woman now, and I'm running for the clock. At first, I couldn't get the door open. It had some kind of crinkly stuff like steel wool on the facing. But I gets it open and gets inside, and it's hot and dark in there. I goes up a dark tunnel up near where the machinery is making all that noise and heat. It's like the power plant they got up through the school. It's burning hot, as if in the house was caught on fire. And I starts to run and trying to get out. I runs and runs till I should be tired, but ain't tired, but feeling more rested as I runs. And running so good, it's like flying. And I'm flying and sailing and floating right up over the town, only I'm still in the tunnel. Then way up ahead, I sees a bright light like a jack-o'-lantern over a graveyard. It gets brighter and brighter, and I know I got to catch up with it or else. Then all of a sudden, I was right up with it, and it burst like a great big electric light in my eyes and scalded me all over. Only it wasn't a scald, but like I was drowning in a lake where the water was hot on the top and had cold, numbing currents down under it. Then all at once, I'm through it, and I'm relieved to be out and in the cool daylight again. I wakes up intending to tell the old lady about my crazy dream. Morning done coming, it's getting almost light, and now I am looking straight in Maddie Lou's face. And she's beating me and scratching and trembling and shaking and crying all at the same time like she's having a fit. I'm too surprised to move. She's crying, "Daddy, Daddy, oh, Daddy, Daddy," just like that. And all at once, I remember the old lady. She's right beside us snoring, and I can't move because I figures if I moved, it would be a sin. And I figures, too, that if I don't move, it maybe ain't no sin because it happened when I was asleep, although maybe
sometimes a man can look at a little old pigtail gal and see him a whole way, you know all that. Anyway, I realize that if I don't move, the old lady will see me. I don't want that to happen. That would be worse than sin. I'm whispering to Matt a little, trying to keep her quiet, and I'm figuring how to get myself out of the fix I'm in without sinning. I almost chokes her. But once a man gets himself in a tight spot like that, there ain't much he can do. It ain't up to him no longer. There I was, trying to get away with all my might, yet having to move without moving. I flew in, but I had to walk out. I had to move without moving. I done thought about it since a heap. And when you think right hard, you see that that's the way things has always been with me. That's just about being my life. There was only one way I can figure that I could get out. That was with a knife. But I didn't have no knife. And if y'all ever seen them gill them young boar pigs in the fall, you know I knowed that that was too much to pay to keep from sinning. Everything was happening inside of me like a fight was going on. Then just the very thought of the fix I'm in puts the iron back in me. Then if that ain't bad enough, Mattie Lou can't hold out no longer and gets to moving herself. First she was trying to push me away, and I'm trying to hold her down to keep from sinning. That I'm pulling away and shushing her to be quiet so as not to wake her ma when she grabs Hope to me and holds tight. She didn't want me to go then. And to tell the honest to God truth, I found out that I didn't want to go neither. I guess I felt then at that time, and although I've been sorry since, just about like that fellow did down in Birmingham. That one what locked himself in his house and shot at them police until they set fire to the house and burned him up. I was lost. The more wriggling and twisting we done trying to get away, the more we wanted to stay. So like that fellow, I stayed. I had to fight it on out to the end. He might have died, but I suspect now that he got a heap of satisfaction before he went. I know there ain't nothing like what I went through. I can't tell how it was. It's like when a real drinking man gets drunk, or like when a real sanctified religious woman gets so worked up she jumps out of her clothes, or when a real gambler man keeps on gambling when he's losing. You got hold to it, and you can't let go even though you want to. Mr. Norton, sir, I said in a choked voice, it's time we were getting back to the campus. You'll miss your appointments. He didn't even look at me. Please, he said, waving his hand in annoyance. True Blood seemed to smile at me behind his eyes as he looked from the white man to me and continued, I couldn't even let go when I heard Kate scream. It was a scream to make your blood run cold. It sounds like a woman who's watching a team of wild horses run down her baby child and can't move. Kate's hair is standing up like she done seen a ghost. Her gown is hanging open and the veins in her neck is about to bust. And her eyes, Lord, them eyes. I'm looking up at her from where I'm laying on the pallet with Mattie Lou, and I'm too weak to move. She screams and starts to picking up the first thing that comes to her hand and throwing it. Some of them misses me, and some of them hits me. Little things and big things. Something cold and strong stinking hits me and wets me and bangs against my head. Something hits the wall. Boom-a-loom-a-loom, like a cannonball, and I tries to cover up my head. Kate's talking the unknown tongue like a wild woman. Wait a minute, Kate, I says, stop it. Then I hears her stop a second, and I hears her running across the floor, and I twists and I looks, and Lord, she done got my double barrel shotgun. And while she foaming at the mouth and cocking the gun, she gets her speech. Get up! Get up, she say. Hey, no, Kate, I says, God damn your soul to hell, get up off my child. Oh, but woman, Kate, listen, don't talk, move, down that thing, Kate, no, down, up. Then there's buckshot, that there's buckshot, woman, buckshot, yes it is, down it, I say, I'm gonna blast your soul to hell. You go hit Mattie Lou, not Mattie Lou, you, it spreads, Kate, Mattie Lou. She's moving around, aiming at me. I done warned you, Jim. Kate, it was a dream. Listen to me. You the one who listened up from there. She jerks the gun and I shuts my eyes. But instead of thunder and lightning busting me, I hears Mattie Lou scream in my ear. Mama, oh, mama. I rolls over. Then Kate hesitates. She looks at the gun and she looks at us and she shivers a minute, like she got the fever. Then all at once, she drops the gun, and zip, quick as a cat, she turns and grabs something off the stove. It catches me like somebody digging into my side with a sharp spade. I can't breathe. She's throwing and talking all at the same time. And when I looks up, man, man, she's got an iron in her hand. I hollers, oh, no blood, Kate. Don't spill no blood. You low down, dog, she says. It's better to spill than to foul. No, Kate, things ain't what they appear. Don't make no blood sin on account of no dream sin. Shut up, nigga. You done fouled. But I sees there ain't no use reasoning with her then. I makes up my mind that I'm going to take whatever she give me. It seems to me that all I can do is take my punishment. I tell myself, maybe if you suffer for it, it will be best. Maybe you owe it to Kate to let her beat you. You ain't guilty, but she thinks you is. You don't want her to beat you, but she thinks she got to beat you. You want to get up, but you too weak to move. I was, too. I was frozen to where I was like a youngin' what done stuck his lips to a pump handle in the wintertime. I was just like a jaybird that the yellow jacket's done stung till he's paralyzed, but still alive in his eyes, and he's watching him sting his body to death. It made me seem to go way back, a distance in my head, behind my eyes, like I was standing behind a windbreak during a storm. I looks out and sees Kate running toward me, dragging something behind her. I tries to see what it is, because I'm curious about it, and sees her gown catch on the stove and her hand coming inside with something in it. I thinks to myself, it's a handle. What she got the handle to? Then I sees her right up on me, big. She's swinging her arms like a man swinging a 10-pound sledge, and I see the knuckles of her hand is bruised and bleeding, and I see it catch in her gown, and I see her gown go up, and so I can see her thigh, and I sees how rusty and gray the cold done made her skin, and I sees her bend and straighten up, and I hears her grunt, and I sees her swing and smells her sweat, and I knows by the shape of the shining wood what she got to put on me. Lord, yes! I sees it catch on a quilt this time and raise that quilt up and drop it on the floor. Then I sees that axe come free. It's shining, shining from the sharpening I'd give it a few days before, and man, way back in myself behind that windbreak, I says, no, Kate, Lord, Kate, no.
Suddenly his voice was so strident that I looked up startled. True Blood seemed to look straight through Mr. Norton, his eyes glassy. The children paused guiltily at their play, looking toward their father.
I might as well been pleading with a switch engine, he went on. I sees it coming down. I sees the light catching on it. I sees Kate's face all mean, and I tightens my shoulders and stiffens my neck, and I waits 10 million back-breaking years. It seems to me like I waits. I waits so long. I remembers all the wrong things I ever done. I waits so long. I opens my eyes and closes them and opens my eyes again, and I sees it falling. It's falling fast. This flops from a 6-foot ox, and while I'm waiting, I feel something wind up inside of me and turn to water. I seize it, Lord, yes, I seize it, and seeing it, I twist my head aside. Couldn't help it. Kate has a good aim, but for that, I moves. Though I meant to keep still, I moves. Anybody but Jesus Christ himself would have moved. I feel like the whole side of my face is smashed clear off. It hits me like hot lead, so hot that instead of burning me, it numbs me. I'm laying there on the floor, but inside me, I'm running around in circles like a dog with his back broke. And back into that numbness with my tail tucked between my legs. I feels like I done have no skin on my face no more, only the naked bone. But this is the part I don't understand. More than the pain and numbness, I feels relief. Yes. And to get some more of that relief, I seems to run out from behind the windbreak again and up to where Kate's standing with the axe, and I opens my eyes and waits. That's the truth. I want some more, and I wait. I sees her swing it, looking down on me, and I sees it in the air, and I holds my breath. Then all of a sudden, I sees it stop, like somebody done reached down through the roof and caught it. And I sees her face have a spasm, and I see the axe fall back of her this time and hit the floor, and Kate spews out some puke, and I close my eyes and waits. I can hear her moaning and stumbling out of the door and falling off the porch into the yard. Then I hears her puking like all her guts is coming up by the roots. Then I look down and I seen blood running all over Mattie Lou. It's my blood. My face is bleeding. That gets me to move, and I gets up and stumbles out to find Kate. And there she is, under the cottonwood tree out there on her knees. And she's moaning. Oh, what have I done, Lord? What have I done? She's drooling green stuff and gets to puking again. And when I goes to touch it, it gets worse. I stand there holding my face and trying to keep the blood from flowing and wonders what on earth is gonna happen. I looks up at the morning sun and expect somehow for it to thunder. But it's already bright and clear, and the sun coming up and the birds is chirping, and I gets more afraid than if a bolt of lightning had struck me. I yells, "Have mercy, Lord, Lord, have mercy," and waits. And there's nothing but the clear, bright morning sun. But don't nothing happen. And I knows then that something worse than anything I ever heard about is in store for me. I must have stood there stark, stone still for half an hour. I was still standing there when Kate got off her knees and went back into the house. The blood was running all over my clothes, and the flies was after me, and I went back inside to try and stop it. When I see Maddie Lou stretched out there, I think, oh, she's dead. Ain't no color in her face, and she ain't hardly breathing. She gray in the face. I tries to help her, but I can't do no good, and Kate won't speak to me, nor look at me even. I thinks maybe she plans to try to kill me again. But she don't. I'm in such a daze, I just sits there the whole time while she bundles up the young'uns and takes them down the road to Will Nichols. I can see, but I can't do nothing. And I'm still sitting there when she comes back with some women to see about Maddie Lou. Won't nobody speak to me, though they looks at me like I'm some new kind of cotton-picking machine. I feels bad. I tells them how it happened in a dream, but they scorns me. I gets plumb out of the house. I goes to see the preacher, and even he don't believe me. He tells me to get out of his house, that I'm the most wicked man he's ever seen, and that I better go confess my sin and make my peace with God. I leaves trying to pray, but I can't. I thinks and thinks until I thinks my brain gonna bust about how I'm guilty and how I ain't guilty. I don't eat nothing. I don't drink nothing. I can't sleep at night. Finally, one night way early in the morning, I looks up and sees the stars, and I starts singing. I don't mean to. I didn't think about it, just started singing. I don't know what it was, some kind of church song, I guess. All I know is I ends up singing the blues. I sing me some blues at night, ain't never been sang before, and while I'm singing them blues, I makes up my mind that I ain't nobody but myself, and ain't nothing I can do but let whatever's gonna happen, happen. I made up my mind that I was going back home and face Kate, yeah, and face Maddie Lou, too. When I gets here, everybody thinks I done run off. There's a heap of women here and with Kate, and I runs them out. And when I runs them out, I sends the young'uns out to play and locks the door and tells Kate and Maddie Lou about the dream and how I'm sorry. But that what done happened is done happened. "How come you don't go on away and leave us?" is the first words Kate says to me. "Ain't you done enough to me and this child?" "I can't leave you," I says. "I'm a man, and a man don't leave his family." She says, "No, you ain't no man. No man do what you did." "I'm still a man," I says. "But what you gonna do after it happens?" says Kate. "After what happens?" I says. "When your black abomination is birthed to bawl your wicked sin before the eyes of God." She must have learned them words from the preacher. "Birth?" I says, "Who birth?" "Both of us. Me birth and Maddie Lou birth. Both of us birth, you dirty, low-down, wicked dog. That liked to kill me. I can understand then why Matty Lou won't look at me and won't speak a word to nobody. If you stay, I'm going over and get Aunt Chloe. For both of us, Kate says. She says, I don't aim to birth no sin for folks to look at all the rest of my life, and I don't aim for Matty Lou to neither. You see, Aunt Chloe is a midwife, and even weak as I am from this news, I knows I don't want her fooling with my women folks. That would have been piling sin up on top of sin. So I told Kate, no, if that Aunt Chloe come near this house, I'd kill her, old as she is. I'd have done it, too. That settles it. I walks out of the house and leaves him here to cry it out between them. I wanted to go off by myself again, but it don't do no good trying to run off from something like that. It follows you wherever you go. Besides, to get right down to the facts, there wasn't nowhere I could go. I didn't have a crying dime. Things got to happening right off. Niggas up at the school come down to chase me off, and that made me mad. I went to see the white folks then, and they gave me help. That's what I don't understand. I'd done the worst thing a man could ever do in his family, and instead of chasing me out of the county, they give me more help than they ever give any other colored man, no matter how good a nigga he was. Except that my wife and daughter won't speak to me. I'm better off than I ever been before. And even if Kate won't speak to me, she took the new clothes I brought her from up in town, and now she's getting some eyeglasses made, what she's been needing for so long. But what I don't understand is how I done the worst thing a man can do in his own family, and instead of things getting bad, they got better. The niggas up at the school don't like me, but the white folks, hoo-hoo, treats me fine.
He was some farmer. As I listened, I had been so torn between humiliation and fascination that, to lessen my sense of shame, I had kept my attention riveted upon his intense face. That way I did not have to look at Mr. Norton, but now, as the voice ended, I sat looking down at Mr. Norton's feet. Out in the yard, a woman's hoarse contralto intoned a hymn. Children's voices were raised in playful chatter. I sat bent over, smelling the sharp, dry odor of wood burning in the hot sunlight. I stared at two pairs of shoes before me. Mr. Norton's were white, trimmed with black. They were custom-made, and there, beside the cheap, tan brogues of the farmer, they had the elegantly slender, well-bred appearance of fine gloves. Finally, someone cleared his throat, and I looked up to see Mr. Norton staring silently into Jim Trueblood's eyes. I was startled. His face had drained of color. With his bright eyes burning into Trueblood's black face, he looked ghostly. Trueblood looked at me questioningly. "Listen to the young'uns," he said in embarrassment, "playing London Bridges falling down." Something was going on which I didn't get. I had to get Mr. Norton away. Are you all right, sir? I asked. He looked at me with unseeing eyes. All right, he said. Yes, sir, I mean that I think it's time for the afternoon session, I hurried on. He stared at me blankly. I went to him. Are you sure you're all right, sir?
Maybe it's the heat, Trueblood said. You got to be born down here to stand this kind of heat.
Perhaps, Mr. Norton said. It is the heat. We'd better go. He stood shakily, still staring intently at Trueblood. Then I saw him removing a red Moroccan leather wallet from his coat pocket. The platinum-framed miniature came with it, but he did not look at it this time. Here, he said, extending a banknote. Please take this and buy the children some toys for me. Trueblood's mouth fell agape. His eyes widened and filled with moisture as he took the bill between trembling fingers. It was a $100 bill. I'm ready, young man, Mr. Norton said, his voice a whisper. I went before him to the car and opened the door. He stumbled a bit, climbing in, and I gave him my arm. His face was still chalk white. "Drive me away from here," he said in a sudden frenzy. "Away!"
"Yes, sir."
I saw Jim Trueblood wave as I threw the car into gear. "You bastard," I said under my breath. "You no-good bastard. You get $100 bill. When I had turned the car and started back, I saw him still standing in the same place. Suddenly, Mr. Norton touched me on the shoulder. "I must have a stimulant, young man, a little whiskey."
Yes, sir. Are you all right, sir?"
A little faint, but a stimulant." His voice trailed off. Something cold formed within my chest. If anything happened to him, Dr. Bledsoe would blame me. I stepped on the gas, wondering where I could get him some whiskey. Not in the town. That would take too long. There was only one place. The Golden Day.
I'll have you some in a few minutes, sir," I said.
"As soon as you can," he said. I saw them as we approached the short stretch that lay between the railroad tracks and the Golden Day. At first, I failed to recognize them. They straggled down the highway in a loose body, blocking the way from the white line to the frazzled weeds that bordered the sun-heated concrete slab. I cursed them silently. They were blocking the road, and Mr. Norton was gasping for breath. Ahead of the radiator's gleaming curve, they looked like a chain gang on its way to make a road. But a chain gang marches single file, and I saw no guards on horseback. As I drew nearer, I recognized the loose gray shirts and pants worn by the veterans. Damn. They were heading for the Golden Day.
"A little stimulant," I heard behind me. In a few minutes, sir."
Up ahead, I saw the one who thought he was a drum major strutting in front, giving orders as he moved energetically in long, hip-swinging strides, a cane held above his head, rising and falling as though in time to music. I slowed the car as I saw him turn to face the men, his cane held at chest level as he shortened the pace. The men continued to ignore him, walking along in a mass, some talking in groups and others talking and gesticulating to themselves. Suddenly, the drum major saw the car and shook his cane baton at me. I blew the horn, seeing the men move over to the side as I nosed the car slowly forward. He held his ground, his legs braced, hands on hips, and to keep from hitting him, I slammed on the brakes. The drum major rushed past the men toward the car, and I heard the cane bang upon the hood as he rushed toward me.
"Who the hell you think you are running down the army? Give the countersign. Who's in command of this outfit? You trucking bastards was always too big for your britches. Countersign me?"
"This is General Pershing's car, sir," I said, remembering hearing that he responded to the name of his wartime commander-in-chief. Suddenly, the wild look changed in his eyes, and he stepped back and saluted with stiff precision. Then, looking suspiciously into the back seat, he barked,
"Where's the general?"
There, I said, turning and seeing Mr. Norton raising himself weak and white-faced from the seat. "What is it? Why have we stopped?"
The sergeant stopped us, sir."
"Sergeant? What sergeant?" He sat up.
"Is that you, General?"
the vet said, saluting.
"I didn't know you were inspecting the front lines today. I'm very sorry, sir."
"What?" Mr. Norton said. "The general's in a hurry," I said quickly.
"Sure is," the vet said. "He's got a lot to see. Discipline is bad, artillery shot to hell." Then he called to the other men walking up the road. "Get the hell out the general's road! General Pershing's coming through! Make way for General Pershing!"
He stepped aside, and I shot the car across the line to avoid the men and stayed there on the wrong side as I headed for the Golden Day.
"Who was that man?"
Mr. Norton gasped from the back seat. "A former soldier, sir, a vet. They're all vets, a little shell-shocked."
"But where is the attendant?"
"I don't see one, sir. They're harmless, though."
"Nevertheless, they should have an attendant."
I had to get him there and away before they arrived. This was their day to visit the girls, and the Golden Day would be pretty rowdy. I wondered where the rest of them were. There should have been about 50. Well, I would rush in and get the whiskey and leave. What was wrong with Mr. Norton anyway? Why should he get that upset over Trueblood? I had felt ashamed, and several times I had wanted to laugh, but it had made him sick. Maybe he needed a doctor. Hell, he didn't ask for any doctor. Damn, that bastard Trueblood. I would run in, get a pint, and run out again, I thought. Then he wouldn't see the Golden Day. I seldom went there myself except with some of the fellows when word got out that a new bunch of girls had arrived from New Orleans. The school had tried to make the Golden Day respectable, but the local white folks had a hand in it somehow, and they got nowhere. The best the school could do was to make it hot for any student caught going there.
That's where we will pick up at in Chapter 3, Context of White Supremacy, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. Not too many times. I'm a very tough critic on writing. I read regularly. I write, have been paid to write quite a bit. And I obviously expressed my views about The Hate U Give. Woo, I'm so glad we are done with that. But man, I think the section when we read Medical Apartheid by Harriet A. Washington, Gus T. Renegade's top five, specifically the chapter where she talks about the Tuskegee syphilis experiment and Nurse Rivers, I just think that is exceptional scholarship. If you have not read Harriet Washington's Medical Apartheid, put that next book on your reading list. But when we read that on the program, I just remember being so impressed that that was the book that we were reading, and being able to read that with the Cows group, like listening to the artistry of Ellison's writing. I am super impressed, like reminded, oh yeah, there's a reason this book is in my top five. If you have comments, questions, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you want to join the discussion, but you do not want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.cc/1race. And that is the number one. Address again, tiny.cc/1race, and that is the number one. When you enter that address, look on the left of the page. You'll see the link for the free VOPE line. Click that link. It will open a small window on your screen. First line, it's a drop down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for the code. That code again, 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name, nickname, you can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that info entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us. Same procedure if you want to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *61. I'll get your hand on the switchboard and you will be able to join the dialogue. Question: with what we heard about Jim Trueblood, in the time of R. Kelly and Bill Cosby, what we heard about Jim Trueblood, is Ellison reinforcing the dangerous myth of the black rapist with this lengthy, very descriptive section on Trueblood? Feel free to respond as we go. Folks who have dialed in with a hand up, lines should be open. Feel free to share comments, questions.
Yes, I'm here.
Greetings, Mr. Demery Four. Hope your wife is recovering.
Greetings, Gus, to the other callers. We're doing just fine. I'll give you an update when something happens. But I'd like to, brought out last time, the riddle of the grandfather on his dying bed, you know, saying those words that caused confusion to the protagonist. And I think that the effect not only caused confusion, but also a lack of decisiveness and a commitment to a choice. So he's just going along. Now he meets up with this Jim Trueblood, whom in his mind is disgusting because of the incident, and it's confusing on why the white people would start to improve Jim Trueblood's condition based upon what has happened to him in his miserable state of being. So now I think he's starting to question his beliefs. But, you know, what was interesting to me was the fact that he felt the needs of the school official that he was driving around when he said he needed a drink. And the way he was feeling about Jim Trueblood, it seems that he was identifying with the white man, the school official, and not Jim Trueblood. But we'll see what happens as we go along. But I'll mute my line on that, give somebody else a chance. Thanks, Bill.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery. For other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
This is Joe from St. Louis. Thanks for allowing me to speak. I think I wasn't able to call in last week, but I heard the archive. I've been exposed to like the first half of this book during short times, but I've never read the full thing through, so it's going to be great getting through it this time. I took a couple of notes, and it was two things in particular that I thought were really, really important. I noticed the use of colors again. He said he used the terms, it was soot black. He said it was pale pink and bordered with black. He's really descriptive, and he's a good writer. He also talked about Mr. Norton, and I think when they pull up on these black people and Mr. Norton is there and kind of wanting to engage with them, I think Mr. Norton is extending his, he's really trying to ledger these black people. He feels like he's made an investment in this group, and therefore, you know, because I bought this product, regardless of where we are, they better kowtow and tell me what I want to hear from them. So I thought that was really, I thought it was kind of like he was purchasing their time in a way. He was coming from this superior position. It was a really interesting exercise of projection that took place with him wanting the main character to get them to do to engage or speak with him. And then the last thing I thought was interesting was that the driver, the main character, when he's driving, he says he mistook the veterans for a chain gang. And I think, I don't know, this is a good writer, man. I don't think he did that on accident. As a person who was coerced into signing into the armed forces, veterans and people who get out of prison are not so similar, especially the black ones. So it was interesting to hear that engagement with the veteran, given that, you know, PTSD really wasn't a thing back then. I can only imagine how traumatized most black veterans were and how they still are now. I engage with them regularly there. It's a mess, both sides. So I thought that was interesting. Thanks for letting me speak. I'll mute my line.
Indeed. Great commentary, Jay in St. Louis. Someone talks about paying attention to metaphors on a regular basis, although that was a simile, same thing. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, everybody. Caller from Virginia. I've heard of this book for many years, but I had never read it. And when I heard that we were going to be doing this in the book club, I asked my daughter if she had read it because I remember seeing it around the house. She's in college now. And it's kind of interesting. You had said, Gus, that this is a book that white people really like. And so I asked her if she read it on her own or if she had read it for a class at some point. And she shared with me that she read it for her AP language class. And so I said, so what did you think of the book? She said, well, I don't really remember much about it, which I thought was kind of strange. So now that I'm hearing the book, I'm thinking that the book was probably way over her head and that it was probably not appropriate for high school students. So that's, I just kind of wanted to start with that. I'm not sure that it is appropriate. I think it's pretty, it would be a little bit too much for a 16-year-old, I think. I don't know how other people feel about that. But onto the passages, I did take some notes, so I kind of did want to share a couple things. When he talked at first about the sharecropper singing, it made me think of the showcasing that Neely Fuller talks about. And I think the whole thing was him being showcased. Even the payment that Mr. Norton gave him at the end of hearing this story, I think that he just wanted access to him so that he could kind of, get something out of his life, even a show or a performance or a story or, you know, this kind of stage even that he had for him to perform on and kind of tell this thing that he had done. And a few people had, I think somebody mentioned last week or a couple people mentioned last week that his talk about his own daughter, Mr. Norton, the way that he, you know, showed her picture and the way that he described her, it seemed a little bit strange. And I felt that same way. And now I think that's kind of unfolding a little bit more in his fascination of this story. He even made this statement, did you cast out the offending eye? And the word Ellison uses is envy, that this, you know, Mr. Norton was looking on True Blood with envy. So it seems like he kind of wanted to know about this experience, kind of in a strange way, perhaps. Because he, you know, maybe he had his thoughts about his own daughter, even though he calls True Blood monstrous. And then he says, I must talk with him. So it was just kind of creepy, I think, the whole thing, you know. And then True Blood saying that he had gotten so much out of the white people for, you know, doing this, I guess, because he got extra help, he got more care, they gave him, you know, food and drink and tobacco just to sit and listen to his stories. I thought that was very much like how, you know, racist white people act. It's very in character for them to, you know, want to showcase a black person and take in what they think is interesting about them, I guess. So that's kind of how I viewed it, but that's all I'll share right now.
Wow. If you think that this is not appropriate for a 16-year-old, and this is not marketed, you know, to teens, well, I don't know what you thought about The Hate U Give, but that is young adult literature, the finest of young adult literature, I'm told, The Hate U Give that we just finished. Yeah, that's interesting because I think this book is really memorable, although the first time I read the book, I was a little bit beyond 16, I think it may have been quite challenging for me to read at 16. Yeah. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Emmy.
Greetings, everyone. I'm thrilled that we are reading this book. This is my first time reading this book. Although it has come across my path many times, I just never read it. Full transparency, I actually didn't even know it was written by a non-white black person. I'm excited to read it, in part because it reminds me of some of the things I did have to read in high school For instance, Great Expectations, which just is an extremely verbose text, but extremely detailed. I remember when I was younger, that was something that I just loved about it. I didn't like the book, but I loved the detail, and I have the same kind of excitement about the detail in this text. I did not get to participate in last week's book club, but I did listen to most of people's commentary and stuff like that, because I did read it on my own. But if I could say anything about the first portion of the text, it is that I am excited that it's written kind of with the end first, or with his, where he is now, and it's retrospective. I like that feel, and especially because he starts off pretty much saying, I learned, unfortunately I'm driving, so I can't quote directly, but he says, it took me so long to learn what it seems like everyone else knew, and that is that I can just be myself, or I have to be myself, or something like that. Later on, when I stop driving, I will find the exact quote. That way I'm not misquoting. But that really struck me deeply, because I feel the exact same way, and definitely seeing how his story is unfolding. You know, he thought he was special or wanted to be special. Then he went to college, and as the story unfolds, I'm sure he becomes jaded or hurt with the realization that none of that matters. And some of the things that he's saying just are very true to me. And I thought it was the break. I'm not sure if he was high or drinking, or it was a dream or whatever it was, but I definitely appreciated his running into the older woman and running back and saying, so what is this freedom? And I don't know, skip, skip, skip. And then it ends pretty much with someone saying, oh, the son says, ask yourself these questions. And I was just like, this is really deep on many, many levels, like a whole different element. Yes, racism, white supremacy, but fundamentally, like, that's kind of what I'm coming to, that I can ask a bunch of people questions, but their answers really don't matter. It's really me. Anyway, that's what I would have said about the last week. I didn't get to listen. I just jumped in, so I don't know where you all left off, but I did read into this session. And if I could say anything, I commend his ability to make me sympathize with a non-white black person who did something that I would otherwise never sympathize with. Not to say I condone the behavior, and whoa, Emmy, what are you saying? I'm saying that I'm saturated with media that always makes me sympathize with some white person in some way that I don't want to, for some behavior that's absolutely despicable. Or even if the behavior was fine, I'm just sitting here sympathizing or having these feelings, you know, for these white people. But in reading the text, I kind of felt a little bit for True Blood. And I was like, man, that is really spectacular work being able to do that. So again, not condoning the act. I'm just saying, as a writer, he did an excellent job at, like, really, really bringing his story to light. I thought it was interesting that the white people are supporting him in this, whereas the black people are not. I think that's true for a lot of black people. Like, white people will support when we do the things that are non-constructive. I think it's interesting that Nor, whatever his name is, the white guy that is being driven around, he's taken to this bar where it was so slick how it was written, but I think he got slapped. But the feeling is that I was at work while I was reading, so it wasn't, you know, I wasn't able to really, really focus, but it was like almost like a crazy house. It's a bar.
Haven't got to the bar scene.
Oh, sorry, but never mind. I'll chime back in later. Thank you all for listening.
Coming up after the second audio segment. Other folks, great commentary. Great to hear that we have a lot of folks who are reading this for the first time or reassessing it. Any other folks that we've missed completely? Did we nab everyone? The caller, before I get the caller, 3637. For any of the folks who were listening at Black Talk Radio Network or attempting to listen at Black Talk Radio Network. The audio stream should be playing there. I think there was a tech issue that was disrupting where just the audio was not streaming at Black Talk Radio Network, but that has been corrected. So you should be able to listen there. If you were listening via the phone line, then you shouldn't have had a problem anyway. The caller at 3637, if you had commentary, line should be open.
Hi, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I just want to make a couple comments here. I didn't take any notes because I read this book so many times, but I just remember when he was driving them to the quote-unquote black part of town, how he described how it was different, how it went from like good and glitzy and just clean to where black people live. And it made me mad because he said that the slave quarters, slave quarters, they held up pretty good. And then he went into his to tell him about Mr. Trueblood. But I don't think Mr. Norton would have even knew about Mr. Trueblood if, I want to say, the Invisible Man bought it up. So maybe that's something that we can work on, like trying not to tell crazy white supremacist stuff, because then he asked him to go there and he's like, I have to meet this man. And yes, I feel like from listening to it and from reading it and listening to it a whole bunch of times, going over the part where earlier, the first reading, Mr. Norton was describing his daughter, and then getting to Mr. Trueblood's part. And I do believe that he gave him the money at the end because he admired him. I just felt like he would have wanted something like that to happen with his daughter, speaking of Mr. Norton. And I didn't take any notes because I've read it so many times, but a great read. Ralph Ellison's a great writer, even when he goes into dream, like the first reading, he went into a dream and I didn't really know what was going on. So we were trying to figure out, was it the marijuana that brought it on? And even when he was telling like the Trueblood, Mr. Trueblood's part, he was like telling us about a dream. And then he even went into a dream into that when he said the white woman came out of the glass out of the grandfather clock. So phenomenal writing and phenomenal reading too, Joe Morton, Mr. Turn Me Loose. I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Indeed, indeed. Caller who dialed in, last four digits, 4114. Did you have commentary? Did you have commentary, or are you just listening?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, everybody pretty much touched on what I was going to say, but yeah, I thought that was a big cowbell when Trueblood had his dream, a big cowbell with the white woman, and it's funny how that seemed to like got him started. Yeah, with his daughter. Yeah, so, and it was all the colorful language, the white bedroom and the white sheets or whatever words he used. So he kind of, the author pretty much set that up, I think, for that, that so-called rape scene. And another thing, he mentioned the pre-invisible days. He mentioned that. And I still have to think about that to see what he's considering. I'm thinking, I don't know if he's more confused. I'm thinking he's more confused. That's the pre-invisible days are about. And he's not sure what's going on. Let's see here. What else do I have here? And as far as like white people wanting to help Trueblood, since they found out that his daughter was pregnant, it's kind of convoluted that, white people want to help him out since, he got his daughter pregnant. And, I think white people are just happy, that, I think the other caller, the female caller, mentioned it, you know, about how white people are convoluted, and they kind of, it kind of confirms that black people are, you know, devious and animalistic, rapists, and they reward that. And they kind of like want to see more black people act like that, it seems like. So we'll give you, if you know anybody else that raped their daughters, we'll give them money too. So, and I couldn't help but think, you know, True Blood, comparing him to, you know, Bill Cosby, you know, because, you know, you got all these white men, Kevin Spacey and all the rest of these white men accused of all this sexual, you know, promiscuity, and always all the media focuses on is Bill Cosby, you know, so it just kind of brought that to mind. And I was curious, Gus, you said you were 16 when you first read this book.
The caller, the female caller, said her daughter was about 16 when she read this book. I said that I was a little bit older than that when I first read this book, and that I don't think I would have, it would have been very challenging for me at 16 to read this.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. But were you conscious, Gus, when you, or less confused when you first read it, or were you more confused?
The first time I read the book, I was more confused. I don't think I had the counter-racist concepts the first time I read the book. So even though I thoroughly enjoyed the book the first time I read it and it really stood out, but I had a very different appreciation for it after I forgot how many times I've read it at this point, but after I got counter-racist information and then read the book, and I've read it several times since then, very, very different appreciation for the book.
Yeah, I see what you mean, because I think unless plenty of black people read Mr. Fuller or Francis Cress Wells, and I think a lot of it would probably go over their head, and they probably wouldn't understand the context on which this book was written. It's kind of like you watch a movie or a book before you become, you know, less confused. It looks like a whole different book or a whole different movie. So maybe a lot of, you know, non-white people read this and didn't quite get, you know, all the references. But that's all I got for now, I guess. But great show, good book. And I'll mute my line. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you kindly. If there are any other folks, anyone else that we missed completely who dialed in that we have not heard from? All right. I will get to my comments, and we will probably have a good 10 minutes or so. So if anybody, and I didn't hear a response to the question, is Ellison's book reinforcing the mythology of the black male rapist? But before I see if anyone wants to take that, some of the notes that I made from the second chapter, I don't think Mr. Morgan, the narrator, announces the chapters as we go. So if you don't have the hard copy text, you'll just have to make a note of that he is not announcing the ends of the chapters. Like we ended chapter 2 and did just a few pages of chapter 3. I probably would have stopped it at the end of chapter 2, but that was my negligence. Anyway, some of the notes that I made at the very beginning, and I mean, I think this was the first sentence of the audio segment today. He says, "Half consciously, I followed the white line as I drove." Just a short sentence like that would not have mattered as much to me before getting some counter-racist concepts and even what Dr. Welsing talks about, and really, really emphasizing that the system of white supremacy dominates everything. So to really pay attention, especially when the term white is invoked explicitly in texts, just rethinking about that. Half consciously, I followed the white line as I drove. My default, I just follow white. White directs where I'm going, where I'm driving, my direction in life. I'm not even, my mind is not even working. I am an automaton, and that is going to come up in this here book. Oh, man. Anyway, that's one. Next, we were passing a collection of shacks and log cabins now bleached white and warped by the weather. I'm just, again, saying I'm paying attention to the colors white anytime it's mentioned in the text, and lots of other colors. He is so descriptive as a writer. Continuing, when he talks about how they would invite the Negras, and then the whites would invite the Negras up to sing their primitive spirituals, and he has that in quotes, their primitive spirituals. There are so many times, and we're so early in the book, where you hear him talking with disdain about other Black people that he thinks are beneath him. The Black people around the school, True Blood, the other Black boys when he's going to give his speech at the Battle Royal, how he was disgusted with them, like, oh, I'm just going to give my speech. Like, that is so common in the system of whites. Grandsister Dr. Frances Cresswells, and she was so fond of mentioning the story with O.J. Simpson, where he was out with some racists and they overheard some other racists say, oh, there's O.J. and some Negras. Or I think they said, yeah, there's O.J. and some Negras. And the racist at the table with O.J. was like, oh, my gosh, I'm so sorry that happened, Juice. You know, that's terrible. And victim O.J., this is back when he's like 20 at USC before, you know, before a lot of stuff. And he said, oh, no, nothing to apologize about. Hey, this is great. They don't think of me as a Negro. Now, that's laughable now. But I mean, that is so many victims of white supremacy, where we have been brain trashed into thinking that, oh, the system of white supremacy is just these other Negroes' fault. If they just got their act together and cleaned themselves up and acted right, everything would be cool. See, because I'm not like that. I'm not like these Negroes. You know, I'm clean cut and I speak well and I got my degrees, and they get so many of us to think that, yeah, I'm special. I'm not like you Negroes. And nobody can give you a reminder like racist man, racist woman, racist child. Continuing. When he's embarrassed, he has so many lines talking about where he's embarrassed and shamed, humiliated by these other Black people. But I love, as Emmy pointed out, that this is being told as a retrospective. He takes a moment to reflect on his own health, self-hate. He says, I didn't understand in those pre-invisible days that their hate, talking about whites, and mine too, was charged with fear, how all of us at the college hated the Black Belt people, the peasants during those days. We were trying to lift them up, and they, like True Blood, did everything it seemed to pull us down. That is successful brain trashing. It's not racists who are to blame. It's these Negroes' fault. If they just got themselves together, we could take, there would be no problem. Let's see. The next thing. Oh, my goodness, the portion where Mr. Norton, this is before they even get to True Blood's whole tale, they're talking, and he says, yes, he fathered a child with his daughter, before he knows all that. He says, well, you see, I mean, the daughter doesn't have a husband. He says, oh, I see, but that shouldn't be so strange. I understand that your people, see, that's right. Almost a reminder right there. That's almost a reminder right there that you're a Negro just like True Blood. I don't see too much difference between you and True Blood. But he caught himself. Mr. Norton stopped, like, whoop, shouldn't be saying that much to the Negro. Like, let's move forward with the storyline. And just little things like that, I did not appreciate the first time I read this, not having a deeper understanding of counter-racism when I went reading it. Now, like, I don't even remember how many times I've read this book. At this point, I think it's like more than four or five at this point, many times. But the first time around, I did not have that understanding. Another one, just paying attention to the colors. He sat back in the seat, his hands grasping his knees, his knuckles bloodless. I looked away down the heat dazzling concrete of the highway. I wished we were back on the other side of the white line, heading back to the quiet green stretch of the campus. Beautiful use of colors, whiteness as safety, away from Negroes like True Blood. I am thinking of HBO's True Blood, their hit vampire series, and if that is related in any way to this character. New Orleans does come up in the book. This True Blood, the series, is in Louisiana. Anyway, Envy, I thought it was so correct. I think last week some of our listeners pointed out, I thought brilliantly, that Mr. Norton seemed to have a pedophilic fetish of his white daughter. And then to transition from, I think Ellison beautifully is leading you right to make that connection, because you go from that, him talking about his daughter, to then you meet True Blood. And the only reason that you're getting this is because Mr. Norton is insistent upon hearing this. The narrator wants to leave. If the person who is telling this story had his way, we would have left. We would have got, you know, very little information about this and been back to the safe whiteness of the campus. The white man has a fetish for this. I think this is speaking much more accurately than a lot of folks think. I don't even know if this gets the white fetish for this sort of behavior. And this is white projection. This is exactly what Dr. Welsing talks about. I think consciously or subconsciously, and I'm going to say maybe he's doing it consciously, that's what Ellison is doing. He is projecting. This is white sexual perversion that they engage in on a constant basis and enjoy reveling in, entertaining. Yes, we want to watch you engage in sexual behavior, these sort of antics. And that is documented. You can even go, and they have some of the histories on their antics worldwide. The whole world is the white man's brothel, where they would go on the continent. Some of the whites in France, they would go and they would force them to rape family members so that they could watch for their entertainment. This is documented in their own history, the white perversions and all of the cuckolding and going and paying a black person to come and have sexual intercourse, you know, with this person's wife and the cat, all of that, the sexual pervert, all of that. Malcolm X talked about that in his autobiography. I think Ellison is doing a beautiful job of giving a very entertaining story that you might casually read this and think, oh yeah, this is once again the black rapist. I don't think that's what this is at all. I think this is showing the white appetite for sexual perversion, and he's just doing it in a really crafty way, but I could be wrong. Let's see. Oh yeah, when Exhibit A, when he says, my gosh, the whole section here. He says, the whites, when he went to the jailhouse, and I give Sheriff Barber the note, and he asked me to tell him what happened, and I told him, and he called in some more men, and they made me tell it again. They wanted to hear about the gals lots of times, and they give me something to eat and drink and some tobacco. That widespread collective white fetish. Yes. Tell us about these stories. We'll give you anything you want. Yes, yes, yes. More, more, more. The white appetite. Delectable Negro Vincent Woodard, also in my top 10, I think would further corroborate. But then the beauty when he says, them big niggas didn't bother me neither. It just goes to show you that no matter how biggity a nigga gets, the white folks can always cut him down. Wow. Explicit, in my view, codification. We just had that talk, retired firefighter, about black leaders. I think that gets shown explicitly in this text over and over again, what happens to quote unquote black leaders and how easily whites can cut them down. Continuing, he says, the white folks took up for me, and the white folks took to coming out to see us and talk with us. Some of them was big white folks too, from the big school way across the state, asked me lots about what I thought about things and about my folks and the kids, and wrote it all down in a book. But best of all, sir, I got more work now than I ever did have before. And I think about the book we just read. Millions of copies in all of the schools. Why would whites promote a book like that? Oh, Tyler Perry film. I mean, we can just go down the line. Why is, what is it? The film that I've never seen with Terrence Howard and all of the folks. It'll come to me. But whatever, the big show on Fox that has been so popular, I think, for 3 or 4 seasons. Anything that is depicting black trashiness, black filth, black perversion, anything that is doing anything other than talking correctly about racism, white supremacy being the cause for black dysfunction. Oh, no, 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 no. We want black people being clowns, buffoons, criminals, thugs, anything like that, or a combination of all of that put together. Yes, give us more of that. Lots of that. We'll promote that. We'll pay money to see that and talk about that. Yes, I think that's exactly what Ellison is illustrating with this portion of the text. I think he did in the dream that was talked about. I think some of the listeners touched on that dream sequence. I think he did a brilliant job of suggesting the incorrectness of this sexual act, the father raping the daughter by, in the dream sequencing, having it being this white woman, him lusting after this white woman coming out of the clock, and in the whole whiteness of the room to show the incorrectness of this act. What could be more incorrect than a black male raping a white woman? Let's see. I think I will stop here, unless there's, I have more notes, but I'm willing to stop here if folks want to either respond to the question or if they have any, or I guess I'll get in two other quick points. I thought the listener's point about the chain gang was important. Metaphors and similes are important. The way that I processed that was, again, this is a retrospective. So the listener, this is when he was more confused. He is super white identified in his view. I think the caller was absolutely correct. When Mr. Norton, we sick boss? Well, yes, we'll get you that. Said it absolutely. That this is when he was more confused. And at that time, he's already shown such total disdain for black people. Absolutely. I think that's the way that he would see these black people, as criminals, not as veterans who've been traumatized, but as total criminals. I don't necessarily think that that is Ellison's view of these black people. I think that is Ellison being a phenomenal artist and just capturing, yes, this is someone who has total disdain for black people. And you see that over and over and over in this portion of the text. I could be incorrect. Is there anything else I need to make sure? Oh, yes. The last thing, again, showing the impotence of the HBCU. They were trying to get the Golden Day shut down, the black people at the college. But he says, but the local white folks had a hand in it somehow, and they got nowhere. Again, black leaders in the system of white supremacy. We have about 4 minutes. Anybody want to respond to the question or have anything that they want to share?
Can I say a couple of quick things?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay, one was concerning the mentioning of General Pershing. I think that the guy suffered from PTSD, you know, marching like a drum major, and then the narrator then playing along like he was in the Army, and they mentioning General Pershing. He had a nickname, General Blackjack Pershing, because he had commanded some black troops. I don't think it was a coincidence that Ralph Ellison would mention his name. And also one other thing, when he was describing the shoes of Mr. Norton, handmade wingtips, and contrasting it with what True Blood was wearing, the Brogans and broken down shoes, to emphasize the difference in the poverty and the state of being that True Blood was in compared to Mr. North. I'll mute my line.
Great points, Mr. Demery. For the caller who dialed in on the VOPE line, your line should be open. Would you like commentary?
Hey, Gus, this is Rob in Wisconsin. I'm not in the quiet place right now, so I'll chime back in later if that's okay.
Yes, sir. Star Wars is a big theme. Any other folks have commentary they want to get in?
Can I say something real quick?
Is this Jay in St. Louis?
Yes.
Go ahead, sir.
Oh, I think that scene with Jim Trueblood, I think it was really important that scene started with a white woman. I just finished Tommy Curry's book, and, you know, just thinking about white women and the eventual tragedy that black men end up experiencing as a result of contact with them in these kind of times. And I also think that Jim Trueblood, his kind of his bragging of like, yeah, you know, those white people treat me nice. I think that's his real exhibition of this perverse incentive system that white supremacy has of rewarding the self-deprecating black people. And he's kind of flaunting that success because I think he knows that the main character is, he's playing into it too, and he's kind of showing them that, you know, I'm better at deprecating myself than you are. That's all I'll say. Thanks.
Hmm. great point. I also, I think that goes along, at least in the way that I'm processing it, that goes along, I think, with Emmy's point. I didn't feel, I think the other characters frequently when you are presented with the black monster character, rapist character, I don't think you have the same thoughts about Jim Trueblood. I don't know how other people felt, but I am not repulsed in the same way that you are by these other characters. I think there's a lot more humanity given to Trueblood. And even I think he's even allowing the audience to enjoy like Trueblood kind of needling the narrator, like seeing him squirm and not want to be there. And I'm like, hey, white people got my, to quote The Hate U Give, white people got my back, Trueblood speaking. I know white people got my back. I know what they want to hear better than you do. I think he is allowing the audience to kind of enjoy this, seeing the narrator squirm in his more confused days, unless I'm misreading. We will stop here. Chapter three is kind of long. Oh, we are about to meet my favorite character in the history of English literature. I will not even tell you who the person is. Favorite character in the history of English literature. Man, oh man. Ralph, if you had commentary that you did not get to share, just make a note and we will have ample time to share Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, Context of White Supremacy. We're picking up on chapter three.
He lay like a man asleep as I left the car and ran into the golden day. I wanted to ask him for money, but decided to use my own. At the door, I paused. The place was already full, jammed with vets in loose gray shirts and trousers and women in short, tight-fitting, stiffly starched gingham aprons. The stale beer smell struck like a club through the noise of voices and the jukebox. Just as I got inside the door, a stolid-faced man gripped me by the arm and looked stonily into my eyes. "It will occur at 5:30," he said, looking straight through me. "What?" "The great, all-embracing, absolute armistice, the end of the world," he said. Before I could answer, a small, plump woman smiled into my face and pulled him away. "It's your turn, Doc," she said. "Now don't let it happen until after me, and you done been upstairs." "How come I always have to come get you?" "No, it is true," he said. "They wirelessed me from Paris this morning." "Then, baby, me and you better hurry. There's lots of money I got to make in here before that thing happens. You hold it back a while, will you?" She winked at me as she pulled him through the crowd toward the stairs. I elbowed my way nervously toward the bar. Many of the men had been doctors, lawyers, teachers, civil service workers. There were several cooks, a preacher, a politician, and an artist. One very nutty one had been a psychiatrist. Whenever I saw them, I felt uncomfortable. They were supposed to be members of the professions toward which at various times I vaguely aspired myself, and even though they never seemed to see me, I could never believe that they were really patients. Sometimes it appeared as though they played some vast and complicated game with me and the rest of the school folk, a game whose goal was laughter and whose rules and subtleties I could never grasp. Two men stood directly in front of me, one speaking with intense earnestness.
"And Johnson hit Jeffries at an angle of 45 degrees from his lower left lateral incisor, producing an instantaneous blocking of his entire thalamic rind, frosting it over like the freezing unit of a refrigerator, thus shattering his autonomous nervous system and rocking that big brick-laying cream puff with extreme hyperspasmic muscular tremors, which dropped him dead on the extreme tip of his coccyx, which in turn produced a sharp, traumatic reaction in his sphincter nerve and muscle, and then, my dear colleague, they swept him up, sprinkled him with quicklime, and rolled him away in a barrel. Naturally, there was no other therapy possible."
Excuse me, I said, pushing past. Big Hallie was behind the bar, his dark skin showing through his sweat-wet shirt.
"What you saying, schoolboy?"
"I want a double whiskey, Hallie. Put it in something deep so I can get it out of here without spilling it. It's for somebody outside." His mouth shot out.
"Hell no!"
"Why?" I asked, surprised at the anger in his thyroid eyes.
"You still up at the school, ain't you?"
"Well, sure."
Well, those bastards is trying to close me up again, that's why. You can't drink till you blue in the face in here, but I wouldn't sell you enough to spit through your teeth to take outside.
But I've got a sick man out in the car.
What car? You never had no car.
The white man's car. I'm driving for him.
Ain't you in school?
He's from the school.
Well, who's sick?
He is.
He too good to come in? Tell him we don't Jim Crow nobody.
But he's sick.
He can die.
He's important, Hallie. A trustee. He's rich and sick. And if anything happens to him, they'll have me packed and on my way home.
Can't help it, schoolboy. Bring him inside and he can buy enough to swim in. He can drink out of my own private bottle.
He sliced the white heads off a couple of beers with an ivory paddle and passed them up the bar. I felt sick inside. Mr. Norton wouldn't want to come in here. He was too sick, and besides, I didn't want him to see the patients and the girls. Things were getting wilder as I made my way out. Supercargo, the white-uniformed attendant who usually kept the men quiet, was nowhere to be seen. I didn't like it, for when he was upstairs, they had absolutely no inhibitions. I made my way out to the car. What could I tell Mr. Norton? He was lying there, very still when I opened the door.
Mr. Norton, sir? They refused to sell me whiskey to bring out.
He lay very still.
Mr. Norton?
He lay like a figure of chalk. I shook him gently, feeling dread within me. He barely breathed. I shook him violently, seeing his head wobble grotesquely, his lips parted, bluish, revealing a row of long, slender, amazingly animal-like teeth.
Sir!
In a panic, I ran back into the Golden Day, bursting through the noise as through an invisible wall.
Hallie, help me, he's dying!
I tried to get through, but no one seemed to have heard me. I was blocked on both sides. They were jammed together.
Hallie!
Two patients turned and looked at me in the face, their eyes 2 inches from my nose. What is wrong with this gentleman, Sylvester? The tall one said.
A man's dying outside, I said.
Someone is always dying,
the other one said. Yes, and it's good to die beneath God's great tent of sky.
He's got to have some whiskey.
Oh, that's different, one of them said, and they began pushing a path to the bar. A last bright drink to keep the anguish down. Step aside, please.
Schoolboy, you back already?
Hallie said. Give me some whiskey, he's dying.
I done told you, schoolboy, you better bring him in here. He can die, but I still got to pay my bills.
Please, they'll put me in jail.
You going to college, figure it out, he said.
You'd better bring the gentleman inside, the one called Sylvester said. Come, let us assist you. We fought our way out of the crowd. He was just as I left him.
Look, Sylvester, it's Thomas Jefferson.
I was just about to say, I've long wanted to discourse with him. I looked at them speechlessly. They were both crazy. Oh, were they joking?
Give me a hand, I said.
Gladly. I shook him. Mr. Norton? We'd better hurry if he's to enjoy his drink, one of them said thoughtfully. We picked him up. He swung between us like a sack of old clothes.
Hurry!
As we carried him toward the Golden Day, one of the men stopped suddenly, and Mr. Norton's head hung down, his white hair dragging in the dust.
Gentlemen, this man is my grandfather.
But he's white. His name's Norton.
I should know my own grandfather. He's Thomas Jefferson, and I'm his grandson on the field nigger side, the tall man said.
Sylvester, I do believe that you're right. I certainly do,
he said, staring at Mr. Norton.
Look at those features, exactly like yours, from the identical mold. Are you sure he didn't spit you upon the earth, fully clothed?
No. That was my father, the man said earnestly. And he began to curse his father violently as we moved for the door. Hallie was there waiting. Somehow he'd gotten the crowd to quieten down, and his space was cleared in the center of the room. The men came close to look at Mr. Norton.
Somebody bring a chair?
Yeah, let Mr. Eddie sit down.
That ain't no Mr. Eddie, man. That's John D. Rockefeller, someone said.
He is a chair for the Messiah. Stand back, y'all,
Hallie ordered.
Give him some room.
Burnside, who had been a doctor, rushed forward and felt for Mr. Norton's pulse.
It's solid! This man has a solid pulse. Instead of beating, it vibrates. That's very unusual. Very.
Someone pulled him away. Hallie reappeared with a bottle and a glass.
Here, some of y'all tilt his head back.
And before I could move, a short, pockmarked man appeared and took Mr. Norton's head between his hands, tilting it at arm's length and then pinching the chin gently like a barber about to apply a razor, gave a sharp, swift movement.
Pow!
Mr. Norton's head jerked like a jabbed punching bag. Five pale red lines bloomed on the white cheek, glowing like fire beneath translucent stone. I could not believe my eyes. I wanted to run. A woman tittered. I saw several men rush for the door.
Cut it out, you damn fool! A case of hysteria,
the pockmarked man said quietly.
Get the hell out the way, Hallie said. Somebody get that stool pigeon attendant from upstairs. Get him down here, quick. A mere mild case of hysteria,
the pockmarked man said as they pushed him away. Hurry with the drink, Hallie.
Hey, schoolboy, you hold the glass. This here's brandy I've been saving for myself.
Someone whispered tonelessly in my ear.
You see, I told you it would occur at 5:30. Already the Creator has come.
It was the stolid-faced man. I saw Hallie tilt the bottle and the oily amber of brandy sloshing into the glass. Then, tilting Mr. Norton's head back, I put the glass to his lips and poured. A fine brown stream ran from the corner of his mouth down his delicate chin. The room was suddenly quiet. I felt a slight movement against my hand, like a child's breast when it whimpers at the end of a spell of crying. The fine-veined eyelids flickered. He coughed. I saw a slow red flush creep, then spurt up his neck, spreading over his face.
Hold it under his nose, schoolboy. Let him smell it.
I waved the glass beneath Mr. Norton's nose. He opened his pale blue eyes. They seemed watery now in the red flush that bathed his face. He tried to sit up, his right hand fluttering to his chin. His eyes widened, moved quickly from face to face, then coming to mine, the moist eyes focused with recognition. You were unconscious, sir, I said. Where am I, young man? He asked wearily. This is the Golden Day, sir. What? The Golden Day. It's a kind of sporting and gambling house, I added reluctantly.
Now, give him another drink of brandy,
Hallie said. I poured a drink and handed it to him. He sniffed it, closed his eyes as in puzzlement, then drank. His cheeks filled out like small bellows. He was rinsing his mouth. Thank you, he said, a little stronger now. What is this place?
The Golden Day,
said several patients in unison. He looked slowly around him, up to the balcony with its scrolled and carved wood. A large flag hung lank above the floor. He frowned. What was this building used for in the past? He said.
It was a church, then a bank, then it was a restaurant and a fancy gambling house, and now we got it,
Hallie explained.
I think somebody said it used to be a jailhouse, too.
They let us come in here once a week to raise a little hell, someone said.
I couldn't buy a drink to take out, sir, so I had to bring you inside, I explained in dread. He looked about him. I followed his eyes and was amazed to see the varied expressions on the patients' faces as they silently returned his gaze. Some were hostile, some cringing, some horrified. Some, who when among themselves were most violent, now appeared as submissive as children. And some seemed strangely amused. Are all of you patients? Mr. Norton asked.
Me, I just runs the joint, Hallie said. These here other fellas.
We're patients sent here as therapy, a short, fat, very intelligent-looking man said. But, he smiled, they send along an attendant, a kind of censor, to see that the therapy fails.
You're nuts! I'm a dynamo of energy! I come to charge my batteries!
One of the vets insisted.
I'm a student of history, sir,
another interrupted with dramatic gestures.
The world moves in a circle like a roulette wheel. In the beginning, black is on top. In the middle, epochs. White holds the odds. But soon, Ethiopia shall stretch forth her noble wings. Then, place your money on the black.
His voice throbbed with emotion.
Until then, the sun holds no heat. There's ice in the heart of the earth. 2 years from now, and I'll be old enough to give my mulatto mother a bath. The half-white bitch, he added, beginning to leap up and down in an explosion of glassy-eyed fury.
Mr. Norton blinked his eyes and straightened up.
I'm a physician. May I take your pulse?
Burnside said, seizing Mr. Norton's wrist.
Don't pay him no mind, mister. He ain't been no doctor in 10 years. They caught him trying to change some blood into money.
I did, too, the man screamed. I discovered it, and John D. Rockefeller stole the formula from me.
Mr. Rockefeller, did you say? Mr. Norton said. I'm sure you must be mistaken.
What's going on down there?
A voice shouted from the balcony. Everyone turned. I saw a huge, black giant of a man, dressed only in white shorts, swaying on the stairs. It was Supercargo, the attendant. I hardly recognized him without his hard, starched white uniform. Usually he walked around threatening the men with a straitjacket, which he always carried over his arm. And usually they were quiet and submissive in his presence. But now they seemed not to recognize him and began shouting curses.
How you gonna keep order in the place if you gonna get drunk?
Hallie shouted.
Charlene! Charlene!
Yeah,
a woman's voice, startling in its carrying power, answered sulkily from a room off the balcony.
I want you to get that stool-pigeoning, jaw-killing, nut-crushing bum back in there with you and sober him up, and then get him in his white suit and down here to keep order. We got white folks in the house.
A woman appeared on the balcony, drawing a woolly pink robe about her.
Now you listen here, Hallie, she drawled. I'm a woman, and if you want him dressed, you can do it yourself. I don't put on but one man's clothes, and he's in Nolan's.
Never mind all that. Get that stool pigeon sober.
I want order down there, Supercargo boomed. And if there's white folks down there, I wants double order.
Suddenly, there was an angry roar from the men back near the bar, and I saw them rush the stairs.
Get him! Let's give him some order. Out my way!
5 men charged the stairs. I saw the giant bend and clutch the posts at the top of the stairs with both hands, bracing himself, his body gleaming bare in his white shorts. The little man who had slapped Mr. Norton was in front, and as he sprang up the long flight, I saw the attendant set himself and kick, catching the little man just as he reached the top, hard in the chest, sending him backwards in a curving dive into the midst of the men behind him. Supercargo got set to swing his leg again. It was a narrow stair, and only one man could get up at a time. As fast as they rushed up, the giant kicked them back. He swung his leg, kicking them down like a fungo hitter batting out flies. Watching him, I forgot Mr. Norton. The Golden Day was in an uproar. Half-dressed women appeared from the rooms off the balcony. Men hooted and yelled as at a football game.
I want order,
the giant shouted as he sent a man flying down the flight of stairs.
They're throwing bottles of liquor, a woman screamed. Real liquor.
That's an order he don't want,
someone said. A shower of bottles and glasses splashing whiskey crashed against the balcony. I saw Supercargo snap suddenly erect and grab his forehead, his face bathed in whiskey. Eee! He cried. Eee! Then I saw him wave, rigid from his ankles upward. For a moment, the men on the stairs were motionless, watching him. Then they sprang forward. Supercargo grabbed wildly at the balustrade as they snatched his feet from beneath him and started down. His head bounced against the steps, making a sound like a series of gunshots as they ran, dragging him by his ankles like volunteer firemen running with a hose. The crowd surged forward. Hallie yelled near my ear. I saw the man being dragged toward the center of the room.
Give the bastard some order. Yeah, I'm 45, and he's been acting like he's my old man.
So you like to kick, huh?
A tall man said, aiming a shoe at the attendant's head. The flesh above his right eye jumped out as though it had been inflated. Then I heard Mr. Norton beside me shouting, No, no, not when he's down.
Listen at the white folks, someone said. He's the white folks' man.
Men were jumping upon Supercargo with both feet now, and I felt such an excitement that I wanted to join them. Even the girls were yelling, Give it to him good, he never pays me. Kill him!
Please, y'all, not in here, not in my place.
You can't speak your mind when he's on duty.
Hell no!
Somehow I got pushed away from Mr. Norton and found myself beside the man called Sylvester. Watch this, schoolboy, he said. See there, where his ribs are bleeding? I nodded my head. Now don't move your eyes. I watched the spot as though compelled, just beneath the lower rib and above the hip bone, as Sylvester measured carefully with his toe and kicked as though he were punting a football. Supercargo let out a groan like an injured horse.
Try it, schoolboy. It feels so good. It gives you relief, Sylvester said. Sometimes I get so afraid of him, I feel that he's inside my head.
There, he said, giving Supercargo another kick. As I watched, a man sprang on Supercargo's chest with both feet, and he lost consciousness. They began throwing cold beer on him, reviving him, only to kick him unconscious again. Soon he was drenched in blood and beer.
The bastard's out cold. Throw him out!
No, wait a minute. Give me a hand, somebody.
They threw him upon the bar, stretching him out with his arms folded across his chest like a corpse.
Now, let's have a drink.
Hallie was slow in getting behind the bar, and they cursed him.
Get back there and service, you big sack of fat. Give me a ride up here, thong buster. Shake them sloppy hips.
Okay, take it easy, Hallie said, rushing to pour them drinks. Just put y'all's money where your mouth is.
With Supercargo lying helpless upon the bar, the men whirled about like maniacs. The excitement seemed to have tilted some of the more delicately balanced ones too far. Some made hostile speeches at the top of their voices against the hospital, the state, and the universe. The one who called himself a composer was banging away the one wild piece he seemed to know on the out-of-tune piano, striking the keyboard with fists and elbows and filling in other effects in a bass voice that moaned like a bear in agony. One of the most educated ones touched my arm. He was a former chemist who was never seen without his shining Phi Beta Kappa key. The men have lost control, he said through the uproar. I think you better leave.
I'm trying to, I said, as soon as I can get over to Mr. Norton.
Mr. Norton was gone from where I had left him. I rushed here and there through the noisy men calling his name. When I found him, he was under the stairs. Somehow he had been pushed there by the scuffling, reeling men, and he lay sprawled in the chair like an aged doll. In the dim light, his features were sharp and white, and his closed eyes well-defined lines in a well-tooled face. I shouted his name above the roar of the men and got no answer. He was out again. I shook him gently, then roughly, but still no flicker of his wrinkled lids. Then some of the milling men pushed me up against him, and suddenly a mass of whiteness was looming 2 inches from my eyes. It was only his face, but I felt a shudder of nameless horror. I had never been so close to a white person before. In a panic, I struggled to get away. With his eyes closed, he seemed more threatening than with them open. He was like a formless white death suddenly appeared before me, a death which had been there all the time and which had now revealed itself in the madness of the golden day.
Stop screaming,
a voice commanded, and I felt myself pulled away. It was the short, fat man. I clamped my mouth shut, aware for the first time that the shrill sound was coming from my own throat. I saw the man's face relax, and he gave me a wry smile.
That's better, he shouted into my ear. He's only a man. Remember that. He's only a man.
I wanted to tell him that Mr. Norton was much more than that, that he was a rich white man and in my charge. But the very idea that I was responsible for him was too much for me to put into words.
Let us take him to the balcony, the man said, pushing me toward Mr. Norton's feet.
I moved automatically, grasping the thin ankles as he raised the white man by the armpits and backed from beneath the stairs. Mr. Norton's head lolled upon his chest as though he were drunk or dead. The vet started up the steps, still smiling, climbing backwards a step at a time. I had begun to worry about him, whether he was drunk like the rest, when I saw three of the girls who had been leaning over the balustrade watching the brawl come down to help us carry Mr. Norton up.
"Looks like Pops couldn't take it," one of them shouted. "He's high as a Georgia pine." "Yeah, I tell you, this stuff Hallie got out here is too strong for white folks to drink."
"Not drunk. Ill," the fat man said. "Go find a bed that's not being used so he can stretch out a while."
"Sure, Daddy. Is there any other little favors I can do for you?"
"That'll be enough," he said. One of the girls ran up ahead.
"Mine's just been changed. Bring him down here," she said.
In a few minutes, Mr. Norton was lying upon a three-quarter bed, faintly breathing. I watched the fat man bend over him very professionally and feel for his pulse.
"You a doctor?"
a girl asked. "Not now. I'm a patient. But I have a certain knowledge." "Another one," I thought, pushing him quickly aside. "He'll be all right. Let him come too, so I can get him out of here." "You needn't worry. I'm not like those down there, young fella," he said. "I really was a doctor. I won't hurt him. He's had a mild shock of some kind." We watched him bend over Mr. Norton again, feeling his pulse, pulling back his eyelid. "It's a mild shock," he repeated.
"This here golden day is enough to shock anybody," a girl said, smoothing her apron over the smooth, sensuous roll of her stomach.
Another brushed Mr. Norton's white hair away from his forehead and stroked it, smiling vacantly.
"He's kind of cute," she said. "Just like a little white baby."
"What kind of old baby?" the small skinny girl asked.
"That's the kind, an old baby. You just like white men, Edna, that's all," the skinny one said.
Edna shook her head and smiled as though amused at herself.
"I sure do. I just love him. Now this one, old as he is, he could put his shoes under my bed any night. Shucks, me, I'd kill an old man like that." "Kill him nothing," Edna said. "Girl, don't you know that all these rich old white men got monkey glands and billy goat balls? These old bastards don't never get enough. They want to have the whole world."
The doctor looked at me and smiled. "See, now you're learning all about endocrinology," he said. "I was wrong when I told you that he was only a man. It seems now that he's either part goat or part ape. Maybe he's both."
"It's the truth," Edna said. "I used to have me one in Chicago."
"Now you ain't never been to no Chicago, gal," the other one interrupted. "How you know I ain't? 2 years ago? Shucks, you don't know nothing. That old white man right there might have him a couple of jackass balls." The fat man raised up with a quick grin. "As a scientist and a physician, I'm forced to discount that," he said. "That is one operation that has yet to be performed." Then he managed to get the girls out of the room. "If he should come around and hear that conversation," the vet said, "it would be enough to send him off again. Besides, their scientific curiosity might lead them to investigate whether he really does have a monkey gland. And that, I'm afraid, would be a bit obscene."
I've got to get him back to school," I said.
"All right," he said. "I'll do what I can to help you. Go see if you can find some ice, and don't worry."
I went out on the balcony, seeing the tops of their heads. They were still milling around, the jukebox baying, the piano thumping, and over at the end of the room, drenched with beer, Supercargo lay like a spent horse upon the bar. Starting down, I noticed a large piece of ice glinting in the remains of an abandoned drink and seized its coldness in my hot hand and hurried back to the room. The vet sat staring at Mr. Norton, who now breathed with a slightly irregular sound.
"You are quick," the man said as he stood and reached for the ice. "Swift with the speed of anxiety," he added, as if to himself.
Hand me that clean towel. There, from beside the basin.
I handed him one, seeing him fold the ice inside it and apply it to Mr. Norton's face. Is he all right, I said?
He will be, in a few minutes.
What happened to him?
I took him for a drive, I said. What, did you have an accident or something?
No, I said. He just talked to a farmer and the heat knocked him out. Then we got caught in the mob downstairs.
How old is he?
I don't know, but he's one of the trustees.
One of the very first, no doubt, he said, dabbing at the blue-veined eyes. A trustee of consciousness.
What was that, I asked?
Nothing. There now. He's coming out of it.
I had an impulse to run out of the room. I feared what Mr. Norton would say to me, the expression that might come into his eyes. And yet, I was afraid to leave. My eyes could not leave the face with its flickering lids. The head moved from side to side in the pale glow of the light bulb, as though denying some insistent voice which I could not hear. Then the lids opened, revealing pale pools of blue vagueness that finally solidified into points that froze upon the vet, who looked down unsmilingly. Men like us did not look at a man like Mr. Norton in that manner, and I stepped hurriedly forward.
He's a real doctor, sir, I said. I'll explain, the vet said. Get a glass of water.
I hesitated. He looked at me firmly.
Get the water,
he said, turning to help Mr. Norton to sit up. Outside, I asked Edna for a glass of water, and she led me down the hall to a small kitchen, drawing it for me from a green, old-fashioned cooler.
I got some good liquor, baby, if you want to give him a drink, she said.
This will do, I said. My hands trembled so that the water spilled. When I returned, Mr. Norton was sitting up, unaided, carrying on a conversation with the vet.
Here's some water, sir, I said, extending the glass.
He took it.
Thank you, he said. Not too much, the vet cautioned.
Your diagnosis is exactly that of my specialist, Mr. Norton said, and I went to several fine physicians before one could diagnose it. How did you know?
I, too, was a specialist, the vet said.
But how? Only a few men in the whole country possessed the knowledge.
Then one of them is an inmate of a semi-madhouse, the vet said. But there's nothing mysterious about it. I escaped for a while. I went to France with the Army Medical Corps and remained there after the armistice to study and practice.
Oh, yes. And how long were you in France? Mr. Norton asked.
Long enough, he said. Long enough to forget some fundamentals which I should never have forgotten.
What fundamentals? Mr. Norton said. What do you mean? The vet smiled and cocked his head.
Things about life. Such things as most peasants and folk peoples almost always know through experience, though seldom through conscious thought.
Pardon me, sir, I said to Mr. Norton, but now that you feel better, shouldn't we go?
Not just yet, he said.
Then to the doctor, I'm very interested. What happened to you? A drop of water caught in one of his eyebrows glittered like a chip of active diamond. I went over and sat on a chair.
Damn this vet to hell. Are you sure you would like to hear? The vet asked.
Why, of course.
Then perhaps the young fellow should go downstairs and wait.
The sound of shouting and destruction welled up from below as I opened the door.
No, perhaps you should stay, the fat man said. Perhaps had I overheard some of what I'm about to tell you when I was a student up there on the hill, I wouldn't be the casualty that I am.
Sit down, young man, Mr. Norton ordered. So you were a student at the college, he said to the vet. I sat down again, worrying about Dr. Bledsoe, as the fat man told Mr. Norton of his attending college, then becoming a physician, and going to France during the World War.
Were you a successful physician? Mr. Norton said. Fairly so. I performed a few brain surgeries that won me some small attention.
Then why did you return?
Nostalgia, the vet said.
Then what on earth are you doing here in this, Mr. Norton said, with your ability?
Ulcers, the fat man said.
That's terribly unfortunate. But why should ulcers stop your career?
Not really, but I learned along with the ulcers that my work could bring me no dignity, the vet said.
Now you sound bitter, Mr. Norton said, just as the door flew open. A brown-skinned woman with red hair looked in.
How's white folks making out? She said, staggering inside. White folks, baby, you done come too. You want a drink?
Not now, Hester, the vet said. He's still a little weak.
He sure looks it. That's how come he needs a drink. Put some iron in his blood. Now, Hester.
Okay.
Okay, but what y'all doing looking like you at a funeral? Don't you know this is the golden day?
She staggered toward me, belching elegantly and reeling.
Just look at y'all. His schoolboy looks like he's scared to death, and white folks here is acting like y'all two strange poodles. Be happy, y'all. I'm going down and get Hallie to send up some drinks.
She patted Mr. Norton's cheek as she went past, and I saw him turn a glowing red.
Be happy, white folks.
Aha,
the vet laughed.
You're blushing, which means that you're better. Don't be embarrassed. Hester is a great humanitarian, a therapist of generous nature and great skill, and the possessor of a healing touch. Her catharsis is absolutely tremendous.
You do look better, sir, I said, anxious to get out of the place. I could understand the vet's words, but not what they conveyed, and Mr. Norton looked as uncomfortable as I felt. The one thing which I did know was that the vet was acting toward the white man with a freedom which could only bring on trouble. I wanted to tell Mr. Norton that the man was crazy, and yet I received a fearful satisfaction from hearing him talk as he had to a white man. With the girl, it was different. A woman usually got away with things a man never could. I was wet with anxiety, but the vet talked on, ignoring the interruption.
Rest. Rest,
he said, fixing Mr. Norton with his eyes.
The clocks are all set back, and the forces of destruction are rampant down below. They might suddenly realize that you are what you are, and then your life wouldn't be worth a piece of bankrupt stock. You would be canceled, perforated, voided, become the recognized magnet attracting loose screws. Then what would you do? Such men are beyond money, and with supercargo down, out like a felled ox, they know nothing of value. To some, you are the great white father. To others, the lyncher of souls. But for all, you are confusion come even into the golden day.
What are you talking about? I said, thinking, lyncher? He was getting wilder than the men downstairs. I didn't dare look at Mr. Norton, who made a sound of protest. The vet frowned.
It is an issue which I can confront only by evading it. An utterly stupid proposition, and these hands, so lovingly trained to master a scalpel, yearn to caress a trigger. I returned to save life, and I was refused, he said. 10 men in masks drove me out from the city at midnight and beat me with whips for saving a human life. And I was forced to the utmost degradation because I possessed skilled hands and the belief that my knowledge could bring me dignity. Not wealth, only dignity. And other men, health.
Then suddenly he fixed me with his eyes. And now, do you understand?
What? I said.
What you've heard.
I don't know. Why? I said, I really think it's time we left.
You see, he said, turning to Mr. Norton, he has eyes and ears and a good, distended African nose, but he fails to understand the simple facts of life. Understand? Understand? It's worse than that. He registers with his senses, but short-circuits his brain. Nothing has meaning. He takes it in, but he doesn't digest it. Already he is, well, bless my soul. Behold, a walking zombie. Already he's learned to repress not only his emotions, but his humanity. He's invisible, a walking personification of the negative, the most perfect achievement of your dreams, sir, the mechanical man.
Mr. Norton looked amazed.
Tell me, the vet said suddenly calm, why have you been interested in the school, Mr. Norton?
Out of a sense of my destined role, Mr. Norton said shakily. I felt and I still feel that your people are in some important manner tied to my destiny.
What do you mean, destiny? The vet said.
Why, the success of my work, of course.
Ah, I see. And would you recognize it if you saw it?
Why, of course I would, Mr. Norton said indignantly. I've watched it grow each year. I've returned to the campus.
Campus? Why the campus?
It is there that my destiny is being made. The vet exploded with laughter.
The campus! What a destiny!
He stood and walked around the narrow room laughing. Then he stopped as suddenly as he had begun.
You will hardly recognize it, but it is very fitting that you came to the golden day with the young fellow, he said.
I came out of illness, or rather, he brought me, Mr. Norton said.
Of course, but you came, and it was fitting.
What do you mean, Mr. Norton said with irritation?
A little child shall lead them,
the vet said with a smile, but seriously. Because you both fail to understand what is happening to you. You cannot see or hear or smell the truth of what you see. And you, looking for destiny.
It's classic. The boy, this automaton, he was made of the very mud of the region, and he sees far less than you. Poor stumblers. Neither of you can see the other. To you, he is a mark on the scorecard of your achievement. A thing, not a man, a child, or even less, a black, amorphous thing. And you, for all your power, are not a man to him, but a god, a force.
Mr. Norton stood abruptly. Let us go, young man, he said angrily.
No, listen. He believes in you as he believes in the beat of his heart. He believes in that great false wisdom taught slaves and pragmatists alike that white is right.
I can tell you his destiny. He'll do your bidding, and for that his blindness is his chief asset. He's your man, friend, your man and your destiny. Now the two of you, descend the stairs into chaos and get the hell out of here. I'm sick of both of you pitiful obscenities. Get out before I do you both the favor of bashing your heads. I saw his motion toward the big white pitcher on the washstand and stepped between him and Mr. Norton, guiding Mr. Norton swiftly through the doorway. Looking back, I saw him leaning against the wall, making a sound that was a blending of laughter and tears. Hurry. The man is as insane as the rest, Mr. Norton said.
Yes, sir,
I said, noticing a new note in his voice. The balcony was now as noisy as the floor below. The girls and drunken vets were stumbling about with drinks in their hands. Just as we went past an open door, Edna saw us and grabbed my arm.
Where you taking white folks? She demanded.
Back to school, I said, shaking her off.
You don't want to go up there, white folks, baby, she said.
I tried to push past her.
I ain't lying, she said. I'm the best little homemaker in the business.
Okay, but please, let us alone, I pleaded. You'll get me into trouble. We were going down the stairs into the milling men now, and she started to scream.
Pay me, then. If he's too good for me, let him pay.
And before I could stop her, she had pushed Mr. Norton, and both of us were stumbling swiftly down the stairs. I landed against the man who looked up with the anonymous familiarity of a drunk and shoved me hard away. I saw Mr. Norton spin past as I sank farther into the crowd. Somewhere I could hear the girl screaming and Hallie's voice yelling,
"Hey! Hey! Hey now!"
Then I was aware of fresh air and saw that I was near the door and pushed my way free and stood panting and preparing to plunge back for Mr. Norton when I heard Hallie calling,
"Make way, y'all!"
and saw him piloting Mr. Norton to the door.
"Whoa!"
he said, releasing the white man and shaking his huge head. "Thanks, Hallie," I said, and got no further. I saw Mr. Norton, his face pale again, his white suit rumpled, topple and fall, his head scraping against the screen of the door. "Hey!" I opened the door and raised him up.
"God damn it! Out again,"
Hallie said.
"How come you bring this white man here, schoolboy?"
Is he dead?
Dead, he said, stepping back indignantly. He can't die.
What'll I do, Hallie?
Not in my place. He can't die,
he said, kneeling. Mr. Norton looked up. "No one is dead or dying," he said acidly. "Remove your hands." Hallie fell away, surprised.
"I sure am glad. You show you all right? I thought sure you was dead this time."
"For God's sake, be quiet," I exploded nervously. "You should be glad that he's all right." Mr. Norton was visibly angry now, a raw place showing on his forehead. I hurried ahead of him to the car. He climbed in unaided, and I got under the wheel, smelling the heated odor of mints and cigar smoke. He was silent as I drove away.
Context of white supremacy, that is it for this week. We'll pick up next week at the very beginning of chapter 4. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Just wanted to make sure that I got in. General Pershing was mentioned before. Second time he's been mentioned on the program. Robert Pershing Foster from The Warmth of Other Suns, his namesake. You have to go way back in the archives, but that is also in my top five, Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns. With that, if you dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Feel free to chime in. Let me see if anybody that we've not heard from at all. The caller at 6946. If you have commentary, you should be with us.
Yes. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to everyone. This is the caller from Wisconsin. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I'm sorry I missed the first part of the broadcast. I had a question. Did you guys discuss why the white men in chapter 2, and I'm trying to remember this man's name, I apologize, Trueblood, did you guys discuss why the white men would be so helpful to him?
Yes.
After the scandal? Oh, you did. Okay. So I will go back in the archives. That was a question I had. I thought it was interesting, chapter 3, on page 74, says, just as I got inside the door, a solid-faced man gripped me by the arm and looked stonily into my eye. "It will occur at 5:30, he said, looking straight through me. "What? The great all-embracing absolute armistice, the end of the world," he said. And then, of course, later on in page 79, he says, "Someone whispered tonelessly into my ear, 'You see, I told you that it would occur at 5:30. Already the creator has come.'" I thought that was interesting because, as I understand it, the definition for armistice is a peace treaty between two warring parties. And in this case, I interpret it as black and white. And I thought it was interesting that Mr. Norton's entrance into the Golden Gate was sort of the signaling of this peace treaty that would come between black and white, and also the godlike, or the equating white people to God again, which has happened several times in the book, and actually happens later on with the vet, of course, you know, that whole, the creator, calling Mr. Norton the creator and what that means. That's all I have right now. I'd love to hear what everybody else has to say. I'll mute my line. Thank you for letting me share.
Indeed, caller in Wisconsin. The caller, last four digits, 9029, 9029. Did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Yes, thank you for taking my call, Gus, and greetings to the listeners and callers as well. I couldn't do the hate that you give. I tried one week, and I couldn't do it. It was too much. I had to sit out on that one. And you doing this book, what a relief. I got to tell you. But jumping right back into the text, obviously, Dr. Bledsoe, wow. Like, wow. A lot of powerful things he was saying. He was getting to the point that I think a lot of people have been trying to explain to our unnamed character, which is he's the one that's more confused than anybody else around him. And including True Blood, he's the one that's lost in this more than anybody else. And he points it out to him in a furious manner, and really goes after what I really liked. He went after Mr. Norton. And I'm so happy that he kind of really digged into him with his words and asked him, he literally asked him questions that he couldn't answer in front of a nameless character. Like, it was very noticeable. I read this book when I was in high school, my sophomore year, and it was way over my head. I enjoyed it, but it was way over my head. And reading it, I read it countless times before, but reading it again now is even better with a lot of the comments that people have been making. It's been really good to hear other comments and different perspectives on it. The line, I believe it was, kill him nothing. I think it was the women in this part of the book, in this section right here, the nameless character made a very good point of stating that the women can get away with saying certain things that we as men cannot, or do certain things that we as men cannot. And it reminded me of what Dr. Tommy Curry spoke about the stereotypes that are placed on us as black men and black women, where there are certain things that even in an office environment that black women can do and say that black men can't, and vice versa. So it was really interesting hearing him point that out. And also when he really sat down, and I felt like the main character's mind just started to turn a little bit when he realized what Bledsoe was starting to say to some degree in the beginning, where he sat down with some kind of fascination about it, but he kind of didn't like it, but he still liked the fact that he was talking to Mr. Norton like that. I thought that was really, really profound. I got to say, I'm really happy to be reading this book again. I couldn't do the hate that you give. It was a little bit too tough for me. I'll mute my line and listen for the other comments. Thank you.
Appreciate that. The Hate You Give, not one of my favorites. Understandable. I think just to clarify, I don't believe we have actually met Dr. Bledsoe yet. He should be coming next week. It is the vet that was doing the talking to Mr. Norton, and what have you, just yes, for listeners. Dr. Bledsoe is coming next week. Other folks that we have, that if you have commentary that you want to share, either with questions, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free. Since folks are waiting, Ivy, we've not heard from you at all. Did you have commentary you wanted to share? You should be with us.
Thank you, Gus. Greetings to you, and greetings to all the callers on the line.
I can't really speak to the text itself right now because I missed the first segment, and I want to go back into the archives tomorrow and listen to it all so that I can put them together. But what I do want to say is that I thoroughly enjoyed, just like in the first study session, I thoroughly enjoyed what I did here because I heard the second part, and the narrator, it's just awesome. It's really, I don't know, just the way his inflections, and I mean, he should be an actor. He might be one. I think someone might have said he was or is, and just he really makes the text very lively. But what I wanted to quickly say, if I can say it quickly, that and I wanted to say this since it was stated last study session about how the hate you give, what if it were well written? And I think it boils down to your definition of what is well written, because, I mean, it's not just about that it's poetic and similes and metaphors. I mean, you had that talking about pixie cuts and, you know, Oreo cookies and, you know, the way that Chris was talked about. So it's like, even if you have, you know, flowery language and poetry and all of that stuff, but you're promoting racism and, you know, all kinds of other just reckless terroristic nonsense, then it's not well written. I think that the most important aspect of something, in my view, that can be considered well written is the content itself. And the content in The Hate U Give is trash. The content of this book is interesting. It's constructive, and and so many other great things, whereas the content in The Hate U Give is none of those things. And so that's why, in my view, the Hate U Give is also poorly written. And that's all I had. I'll mute my line. Thanks, Gus. Thanks, everyone.
Interesting commentary on quality of writing. I guess you could put that in quotes. Apologies for the tech issues. Hopefully that will not happen. And thanks again to the folks who alerted me that they were not hearing the audio, but got it corrected. Other folks, if we've not heard from you, or if you have commentary you want to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am, Emmy.
Thank you. The primary thing I think I would want to say for the second portion of this week's reading is the switch that the white man, I think it's just Norman, correct? It's Norman, right?
Norton, Mr. Norton.
Norton. That Norton makes after we hear Vet speak, two things. One, I am excited about hearing the placement of importance on actual character and morals and values and like questioning sanity, what is sane or what is insanity or insane, what's crazy and what's not crazy. And I think the author is doing a great job at putting that at the forefront, at least in my mind. Like that's how I'm internalizing the text. That, you know, there's a difference between having a bunch of degrees and all of this other kind of stuff, and then actually being present and being real, being human. And I think that's kind of the dichotomy that I was feeling at the bar scene or at the bar experience, whatnot. But the switch that Norton made, it was very interesting. So we have him with True Blood, who he's absolutely fascinated, able to live out his lustful fetishes for raping his own daughter, which maybe he did or wished he had done before she died or whatever, then juxtaposed with Vet at the bar, who he's fascinated with for a moment, because it's like, oh, you're fascinating. You have this degree. You're a great doctor. What happened? And immediately when Vet begins to tell him the unadulterated truth, as, you know, I was almost killed for trying to help someone. And so all I wanted was dignity and not money. And that real visceral truth that I felt coming out of that completely put off Norton, to where Norton, you know, after having left the bar and finally got back in the car, was like, yeah, he's crazy. When he spoke such truth and even, you know, was disgusted with their presence and what's about to happen with the Invisible Man, the character, the protagonist, and what's going to happen to him if he doesn't wise up and open his eyes and realize what's going on, that he's not the first and he's not special, that he's surrounded by people who thought they were the first or thought they were special, and look at them now. But at any rate, I thought it was very interesting because Norton was absolutely dismissive and was like, yeah, I think he's just crazy, but didn't call Trueblood crazy for that entire story with the whole dream and all of that. I thought that's very interesting. And the final thing I think I would say is that, you know, I stress this now when I talk to certain people, that white people enjoy going around non-white people because they feel like in their environment. White people, I don't know how to explain it because I'm not white, but I definitely feel it. They just enjoy going, I guess, to the underbelly of society where we reside and, you know, where we have all of our problems and all of that. So it's like trips to the so-called ghetto or trips to so-called third world countries, things like that. White people like that. And that is what I feel this entire experience with Norton was. Like, that's what he wanted. And saying, yeah, just drive me wherever. And then they ended up going into all these, you know, areas filled with black people. Norton was able to be that voyeuristic white person, you know, vampirically sucking out the energy of all the non-white people around and then just dismissing whoever he wanted to dismiss when he didn't like the truth that he heard. Thank you all for listening.
Context of white supremacy. Appreciate that, Emmy. Any of the other folks have commentary that they wanted to share? Everyone else satisfied? While folks are waiting, I will make sure I get my notes in from chapter 3. The poor man, when I think about a 16-year-old reading this book, like one of the first notes I took from this second audio segment. So you've got these two folks at the Golden Day. They're talking. He says, two men stood directly in front of me, one speaking with intense earnestness. And Johnson hit Jeffries at an angle of 45 degrees from his lower left lateral incisor, producing an instantaneous blocking of his entire thalamic rind, frosting it over like the freezing unit of a refrigerator, thus shattering his autonomous nervous system and rocking the big brick-laying cream puff with extreme hyperspasmic muscular tremors, which dropped him dead on the extreme tip of his coccyx. I mean, and it goes on like that, but I don't think most 16-year-olds are aware that all of this gibberish is talking about Jack Johnson against Jim Jeffries, which was like the biggest fight since Floyd Mayweather McGregor that took place at the beginning of the 20th century. Jack Johnson, first black heavyweight champion, cowbell, was locked up on that. In fact, Donald Trump is talking right now, just this month, was talking about maybe giving him a pardon. Allegedly, Sylvester Stallone was talking to him on the phone saying, you know, come on, man, you know, this would be a great way to get the Negro voters. You know, you should go ahead and give him a pardon anyway. But I think most 16-year-olds, I could be wrong, would probably have no idea what that is referencing. And I would add that I think that that is kind of an important signifier to toss that in randomly. The same thing like with General Pershing. These are not just coincidental references. These are important reference points. And particularly, I'm saying that the counterviolence is also something that should be noted. There is a lot of counterviolence in this book. To go from the book that we just read that's supposed to be the Black Lives Matter book, and all of the violence is pretty much black people against other black people. You have the police shooting, white supremacy, white person killing a black person, but that gets pushed to the background. In this book, you have repeated examples of counterviolence, or at least references to black violence against white people. This book started with the narrator saying that he headbutted that white guy who bumped him, and that he should have killed him, and that he might be regarded as negligent for not doing so at some point. And now you have the reference to Jack Johnson at this point. Just thought that was important, and people talking about maybe some things being over their head. I thought it was important going back to the colors when he's at the bar and Hallie sliced the white heads off a couple of beers with an ivory paddle and passed them up the bar. This is when he is refusing to give the narrator a beer to take out to the car so that Mr. Norton doesn't have to come inside to experience all of this. And then he comes back from that. He goes back and sees Mr. Norton lay like a figure of chalk. His white suit and down he... Oh, wait a minute. Make sure I get the whole passage. I want you to get that stool-pigeoning, joy-killing, nut-crushing bum back in there with you and sober him up, then get him in his white suit and down here to keep order. We got white folks in the house. This is Haley demanding that they get Supercargo to keep, you know, things in line. And emphasis added because of white people being present. We've heard this before throughout our book study and just in general in the system of white supremacy, different conduct if white people are going to be present. And him wearing whiteness to signal to signify order. The portion, I think it's so important, and he does such a good job. And even the narrator, Mr. Morgan, is adding because he adds a lot of stutters when the narrator is speaking the main character that are not in the text to emphasize his anxiety and fear with this white man. And I think Ellison does a great job, even without those stutters, of conveying that. And then just passages like this where he says, suddenly a mass of whiteness was looming 2 inches from my eyes. It was only his face, but I felt a shudder of nameless horror. I have never been so close to a white person before. In a panic, I struggled to get away. With his eyes closed, he seemed more threatening than with them open. He was like a formless white death suddenly appeared before me, a death which had been there all the time and which had now revealed itself in the madness of the golden day. Extraordinary writing, but I think that is so critically important. I mean, that's when I say this, I think this book reveals so much truth. I think so many of us, after centuries, generations of terrorism, we have to varying degrees that layer of fear in dealing with whites at work, or sometimes just in general, in what we say to them, and automatically changing our conduct in the way that we talk to and behave in the presence of whites. Something that I think is very important, should be addressed. And the conduct, I mean, to contrast his behavior of the main character with that of the veteran, wow. And I think adhering, having a counter-racist code can help us confront that fear, have intelligent fear, as Mr. Fuller talks about, and be courageous in confronting racist man, racist woman, racist child, having a code and some black self-respect. A few other notes, and then I'll check and see if any other listeners. I thought so important, the veteran, favorite character in the history of English literature. I'm so glad that this is not the last time that we will see the vet. He will be back later in the text. But when he breaks on the scene and he is telling our young character to calm down, stop shouting, and he says, remember, he's only a man. He says it to him again. Remember that he's only a man. Extremely important to remember that this is a problem created by people. Mr. Fuller says that all the time. Whites are not gods as projected by the system of white supremacy, white Jesus, the religion of white supremacy. I even thought the character's follow-up was important as well. Immediately after the vet says he's only a man, I wanted to tell him that Mr. Morton was much more than that. He was a rich white man and in my charge, but the very idea that I was responsible for him was too much for me to put into words. Again, the richness of the writing, and I mean the truth of the system of white supremacy. And I mean, niggers have been killed for less, even now, 2018. And this is this book was written in 1952, but this is set in the 1920s. So I mean, this is like 30 years, 35 years before Emmett Till was castrated and lynched. So I mean, just to put that in perspective, all of the cowbell talk at the Golden Day, the sex workers and what have you about, again, I think Ellison doing a brilliant job being very tongue-in-cheek, showing white perversion and the white fetish for black bodies. Brilliant job of being kind of tongue-in-cheek in the way that he's presenting it. I thought just the vet, medical apartheid, Harriet A. Washington mentioned that again, but I mean, That is the system of white supremacy. He wants to be a doctor. He wants to heal. The system of white supremacy, you're a nigra, and that's your charge. I thought it's so eloquent the way that it's constructed, this character. And he says he's just striving for dignity, which, again, always reminds me of Mr. Fuller. He says, what's a dignified slave and a silly one? But just striving for dignity. And exactly as Emmy said, that gets to, in fact, he calls him crazy. This is just a crazy nigga, which reminds me of Protest Psychosis, the book that talks about how whites have been doing this for eons. Any black person, draptomania, any black person who has the audacity, I've been mistreated. You all are practicing white supremacy. Oh, this nigga's crazy. Let's lock him up. Let's lynch him. Let's, you know, stuff him with some to anything. But we are not going to accept this as legitimate, honest commentary, an indictment of our terroristic behavior. Absolutely not. Crazy nigger. We'll see him again, the veteran. I'm so glad. White folks, another homage. Maya Angelou used that term too. I don't know if that's a throwback. I try to incorporate it into my writing to use white folks together as one word, but she used the exact same. In fact, she said, I remember it vividly. She said, whites were not people. They were white folks. And she, as I said, pushed together one word, white folks. I love the portion as well. I think some people saying the main character is starting to wake up when he's watching the vet talk to Mr. Norton, and the vet starts to get upset and is indicting him and all this. And he says, the one thing which I did know was the vet was acting toward the white man with a freedom which could only bring on trouble. Man, have I heard that in reference to Gus T. many, many, many times over the years. He says in the very next sentence, yet I received a fearful satisfaction from hearing him talk as he had to a white man. Gus T. has heard that many, many, many times over the years, white men and white women that we've talked to on the cows and in real life. The next paragraph over, when the vet's talking to Mr. Norton and he says, you should be glad that folks downstairs are doing all of their craziness and are not focused on you. They might suddenly realize that you are what you are. There are so many points in this book. I feel like Ellison is being very explicit about what the problem is, and even frequently talking about counterviolence against whites in the text, and referring symbolically to Norton as a lyncher. Let's see. Yeah, a really powerful portion where he talks about being whipped for saving a walking zombie. I said that was going to be big. You should pay attention to that. The automaton zombie, those are major motifs in the text all the way to the conclusion. That's something to keep in mind, along with counterviolence, I'm saying, and the use of color. I have other notes, but I'll stop there. Did any of the other listeners have commentary that you wanted to make sure you got in before we wrap things up?
Hi, can I be heard again?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I just wanted to say thank you to Emmy for her commentary. I really appreciated that, and that was very, I think it was articulated. I was thinking similarly. It was articulated very well, so thank you for that. Also, Gus, I really enjoy your commentary. How many times have you read this book?
Too many to remember.
All right, awesome. Thank you for that note on Johnson versus Jeffries. I actually did not know that, so that was very, very helpful. Very interesting. I did not think that when I was reading that. I did think that his the gentleman. I think it's on page 81 in my text. Where he said, I'm a student of history, sir. The world moves in a circle like a roulette wheel. In the beginning, black is on top. In the middle epoch, white holds the odds. But soon Ethiopia shall stretch forth her noble wings and place your money on the black. I enjoyed that. I think that is, I thought that was a really interesting passage. It tells me white supremacy has not existed since the beginning of time. You know, and again, it goes back to that idea that white people created this. People created this. And as Mr. Fuller says, you know, whatever people have created, people can take apart. That's a paraphrase. But that was sort of a reminder of that. This has not always existed, and it will not always exist as long as we remain focused on trying to solve the problem. Thank you again. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that. Absolutely. Any other folks have comments they want to make sure they get in before we conclude? Everyone satisfied?
I'll add what the codified software developer just said. I think that was brought up earlier. I could be incorrect about the problem being solved. That's music to my ears because, you know, I'm not a person who is prone to depression, but I'll just, you know, share some kind of candid. Not too long ago, I was thinking about something related to white supremacy, something recent, some current event that happened. And I just felt, truth be told, in that moment, I haven't felt that way since, but in that moment, I felt suicidal. I just wanted to leave here. And I know that that's not very codified, and I'm not being a good soldier in that. And even with R. Kelly, what you said, Gus, when you posted on your Facebook page how they're taking him off of Spotify, and to my knowledge, you've never been convicted of anything. And to me, that's just a tactic. The way that I see it, it might be a strategy to take people's funds, the black people's funds, while they're still making them, in addition to attacking their funds right when they're about to pass them down, like they're doing to Bill Cosby. And I also find very strange that his children keep dying. And just when I saw that with R. Kelly, it was just like, man, you know, here goes another one. It just made me really, really, I didn't feel suicidal at the time, but I felt really, really sad and sort of just really, really down. It to the point where I was reading the code book, and I was getting to the politics part, and I was, you know, going to read my section for the day. And when I saw that, I couldn't even read it because I just didn't want to hear or read anything about just white people at all. It really just got to me like that because I'm just so sick of them, and I'm just so, it's just so hard to just see these just constant attacks and constant barrage of attacks. And I'll leave it there. Thanks, Gus. Thanks, everyone.
Well, that is the system of white supremacy. I think it's designed to have us depressed and sad, seeing black people and ourselves and people that we care about being terrorized and abused all the time. So that's, I think, very common, unfortunately. Certainly not anything that, you know, folks are happy to feel or experience or certainly even want to share in a public forum. But I mean, that is just the reality of the system of white. Even our narrator here is dealing with depression, I think, at various points in the book, and certainly after what happens next week. But that'll be more to come. But do not be discouraged. Dr. Welsing would say that regularly when she visited the broadcast. Be not discouraged. You certainly can, and all of us, we're human, get sad when these type of things happen, but we certainly want to be committed to resolving this problem so we don't have to continue enduring this sort of terrorism, because that's exactly what whites have in store for us. With that, we'll be here next week. We'll be right at the beginning of chapter 4. I cannot wait to hear more from the vet. If you want to write in, if you have commentary, feel free, untiljustice@gmail.com. Hopefully no issues next week. I'll make sure the audio is working correctly, streaming, so you can listen online or via the phone line. My apologies. And thanks again to the folks who alerted me that they were having issues so that we could correct the problem. We'll be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Looking forward to reviewing, catching up on what's gone down over the past 7 days and any counter-racist suggestions that folks have. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in and enjoying being able to reread this text. I it's just outstanding. I really have a lot of regard for this book, especially, and hope that people are getting constructive info on racism, white supremacy from reading a book that is fiction. That said, I know it's nice weather, supposed to be at a baby shower this weekend. Folks are going out to frolic and have fun. It's almost summertime. Great. You still want to be codified? I would suggest sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Race soldiers, you just heard all that. Alcohol being involved didn't sound like a lot of constructive behavior. That's pretty common. If we can, to the best of our abilities, I think rejecting all of white's narcotics would be in our best interest. Dr. Welsing, many of the other folks that we highly esteem, I think they would strongly encourage us to keep our brain computers safe, working optimally, so that we can do all that we can to solve the problem of racism, white supremacy efficiently, permanently. Certainly, if we're going to be out and about driving in a vehicle, we want to be buckled up and sober. Let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.